Barnard?
Here.
Bebout?
Here.
Boner?
Here.
Burns?
Here.
Case?
Present.
Christensen?
Here.
Coe?
Here.
Cooper?
Here.
Kraft?
Here.
Dockstetter?
Here.
Driscoll?
Here.
Emmerich?
Here.
Esquivel?
Here.
Geis?
Here.
Hastert?
Here.
Hicks?
Here.
Johnson?
Here.
Hinsky?
Here.
Landon?
Here.
Meyer?
Here.
Pappas?
Here.
Perkins?
Here.
Peterson?
Here.
Ross?
Here.
Rothfuss? Scott?
Here.
Von Platern?
Here.
Wasserberger?
Here.
President Nicholas?
Here.
29 present, 1 excused.
Good morning, and Pastor Mender will lead us with a prayer. He'll pick on some of us, but you probably deserve it.
Let's pray, please. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for another day, and we thank you that your mercies are new and great is your faithfulness, and we ask that you help us with the work that we have to do today. Father, today I want to pray for these senators, from Casper, Jim Anderson, from Lander, Cale Case, from Alta, Leland Christensen, from Cody, Hank Coe, from Kemmerer, Stan Cooper, and from Rock Springs, the lone woman senator, the beauty among the beasts, the queen of the Senate, Bernadine Kraft. Give these senators patience, wisdom, and endurance as they work together today, and I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Amen. Please join me in the flag. All right, the pledge of allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Play ball. Perhaps, Reverend, Pastor, you could write those nice words down for us so we could remember them when we address Her Highness.
She's your tiara out of there.
Yeah, that's the tiara. Will come out. Yeah, go get it from the vault. All right. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. May I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. President. Members of the Senate, on that stack of papers on your desk is one that's called Senate Confirmation of Boards. And this is an information piece for all of you. If you have anybody in your district or anyplace else in the state of Wyoming that's interested in any of these boards, and this is the list of the boards where appointments are available, you know, please get the name into to the governor's office, Carrie Jo, chief of staff. And we're getting down to the wire. As you all know, we have to have confirmation hearings before we leave this budget session for all of the appointments for this year. So if you have any ideas or thoughts on citizens who want to serve, please get their names in. Thank you.
I think, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, you got the list, and it's up to you to go look and see whether it's your district that's open or what the position is open to make sure that you're not spinning your wheels. So go look at the Internet or look in your directory to see whether or not, if it's geographical, whether your area is even available for the appointment. We're at that order of business of reading, correction, approval of the journal. Will the reading clerk please read the journal committee report?
Mr. President, your journal committee reports that the journal of February 15, 2016 has been read and recommends that it be approved. Senator Wasserberger, chairman.
Are there any objections? There being none, the report is adopted. With new business, we have our doctor of the day is Dr. Kirvin from Buffalo. I don't see Larry out there, but we'll. And then our nurse of the day is Kristen Colbrand from Newcastle. She was here yesterday. I don't see her out there, but we'll welcome them when they get here. Today in Wyoming history, in 1890, Robert C. Morris suggested the Equality State as a state motto. Morris was the son of Esther Hobart Morris. Today is day 7 of the proposed 20-day session. Thursday is the last day for bills to be reported out of committee in the House of Origin. Reports from standing committees.
February 15, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, to whom was referred Senate File 60, Public Health Nursing, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Boner, Kraft, Driscoll, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. February 15, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, to whom was referred Senate File 70, Off-Road Recreational Vehicles, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Boner, Emmerich, Escobel, Johnson, and Meyer, Senator Meyer, Chairman. February 15, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, to whom was referred Senate File 4, Military Service Member Protections, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Boner, Emmerich, Escobel, Johnson, and Meyer, Senator Meyer, Chairman. February 15, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, to whom was referred Senate File 12, Vietnam War Commemoration 2, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Boner, Emmerich, Escobel, Johnson, and Meyer, Senator Meyer, Chairman.
Messages from the House? None. They're not doing anything over there. Bills on second reading. Senate File 10, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 10, Firearms Exemption from Execution.
There are no amendments, no discussion. Senate File 10 having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, is so ordered. Senate File 15, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 15, Hathaway Scholarship Eligibility.
There are no amendments. Is there no discussion? There being none. Senate File 15, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, is so ordered. Senate File 29, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 29, Legislator Participation in State Benefits Plans.
There are no amendments. There's no discussion. There being none. Senate File 29, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, is so ordered. Senate File 40, Abandoned Mine Land Funds. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. I would ask that Senate File 40 be laid back for one day.
Without objection, Senate File 40 is laid back for one day till tomorrow for second reading. Senate File 81, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 81, School Capital Construction Charter School Leases.
There are no amendments, no discussion. There being none, Senate File 81 having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, is so ordered. We're at that order of business of third reading and final passage of bills. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do you have a consent list?
Mr. President, we do have a consent list. I move third reading consent list, which is as follows. Senate File 3, Permissive Preference for Veterans in Private Employment. Senate File 31, Omnibus Water Bill Planning. Senate File 32, Alternative School Accountability. Senate File 34, Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. Senate File 37, Boards and Commissions Party Affiliation. Senate File 45, Rural Health Care Districts Authority. Senate File 46, Asset Forfeiture 1. And Senate File 61, Occupational Health and Safety Act, Civil Penalties.
Would any of the members like any of those bills removed from the consent list? Having been read three separate times, the question is, shall these bills pass the Senate? Senate File 3, Permissive Preference for Veterans and Private Employment. Senate File 31, Omnibus Water Bill Planning. Senate File 32, Alternative School Accountability. Senate File 34, Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. Senate File 37, Board and Commission's Party Affiliation. Senate File 45, Rural Health Care District's Authority. Senate File 46, Asset Forfeiture -1. Senate File 61, Occupational Health and Safety Act -Civil Penalties. The reading clerk will please call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Boner?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstetter?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Emmerich?
Aye.
Escobel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert? Hicks?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Kinski?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Pappas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Platern?
Aye.
Wasserberger?
Aye.
President Nicholas?
Aye.
On the consent list, 30 aye. Senate File 3, are there any changes?
Case
aye to no.
Rothfuss
aye to no.
Nicholas aye to no.
Nicholas aye to no.
Perkins aye to no.
Dockstetter aye to no. Ross
aye to no.
Driscoll aye to no. Emmerich aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 3, 22 aye, 8 no. Senate File 31, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 31, 30 aye. Senate File 32, are there any changes? Case aye to no. Meyer aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 32, 28 aye, 2 no. Senate File 34, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 34, 30 aye. Senate File 37. Geis, aye to no.
Hastert, aye to no.
Rothfuss, aye to no. Emmerich, aye to no. Kraft, aye to no. Escobel, aye to no.
Nicholas, aye to no.
Nicholas, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 37, 23 aye, 7 no. Senate File 45, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 45, 30 aye. Senate File 46. Are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 4630-I. Senate File 61. Are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 6130-I.
Having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate File 3, Senate File 31, Senate File 32, Senate File 34, Senate File 37, Senate File 45, Senate File 46, and Senate File 61 have all passed the Senate. Senate File 2, third reading of the bill.
Senate File 2, Attorney General Opinions, Legislative Request, sponsored by the Management Council, an act relating to administration of government.
We have amendments. Would the reading clerk please read in the First Amendment?
Senate File 2, third reading amendment number 1, page 2, line 6.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, I'd move third reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 2. Mr. President, I would move third reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 2. Members of the body, after looking through this legislation, there's a couple things that concern me, and primarily is how we discipline our own selves. And when we look at this, I think there's some provisions in here that are appropriate. I think the appropriateness of those, when we look at subsection B, that we do these through rules and regulations, and there's a precedent set for doing that. Currently, under our form of government, we discipline ourselves. And if we have issues of abuse or any other provisions in law, it's up to the body to discipline us, not a subdivision of that body. So I think that's an appropriate use that we do that through rules. So if there is issues associated with asking an AG's opinion, that's the appropriate mechanism to do it through rules that we adopt and everybody votes on in the Senate. I think it's a stretch to then get into the point where we're now allowing a subdivision of the Senate to dictate when you can and can't act. I would equate it to the equation of it's probably okay to put a horse on a rider, but when you equip that rider with spurs and whips, it might start to get a little bit to the point where we may want to reconsider how we're doing business. Members of the body, I would ask that you adopt this. The only thing it does is go in there, and it takes your ability to access the Attorney General's office, puts it back to you, and does not put management counsel between you and the opportunity to represent your 18 to 20,000 constituents that you represent. Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for any questions.
Senator B. Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, on and against the amendment, and as I look at this, we're going to delete D, which deals with the potential personal conflicts.
No. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, it deletes C, which is the Management Council request, and renumbers D.
Well, Mr. President, one of them would be a bad amendment, and I would oppose it.
Good rebound.
You learn that when you play basketball, Mr. Chairman, how to be a good rebounder so those guards can shoot. Mr. President, really, I think this is pretty important that there are certain circumstances that come up, and this is where one of the areas where you've seen the most abuse of the use of the Attorney General, and there's no clear direction as to how that happens if you, as a sitting member of the legislature, wishes an Attorney General's opinion outside the session. There are a lot of times where I think these things are pretty important and certainly need to be looked at, so there's nothing wrong with going to Management Council when we're not in session to ask for their review of this, and in fact, if they think it's worth, if it has merit to go to the Attorney General, I think it's a tool we need. You know, we really can't implement it in rules because if we do it in rules, it's, you know, we're out of session. There's no way really to get the Attorney General to do an opinion, so I would ask you to defeat the amendment.
Discussion on the amendment before the sponsor takes a second time. Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, I would just point out.
Oh, I've got Senator Bernard, excuse me. You're good.
Mr. Chairman, I just point out that if there is abuse, we can deal with that through rules because it already says that in here. If you go to subsection B, it says in accordance with the rules of each house. That provision's already in the bill and we're leaving that in there. So how can we not adopt rules, but yet this thing says we can adopt rules? So I would say that that's kind of a counter argument against the amendment. The simple fact is we've already specified that we can do this through rules, and that is an appropriate mechanism. And I think that addresses those issues. Let's do this through rules. Let's let everybody participate in that rulemaking decision, give you the ability to weigh in. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd call for the question.
The question having been called for, all those in favor of third reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 2, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Division having been called, all those in favor, please stand. Fifteen. All those opposed, please stand. The chair votes no. The amendment has failed.
The
vote was 15-15 with chair voting no, so the it failed for lack of a majority. We're back on the bill, third reading amendment number 2 to Senate File 2. If the reading clerk would please read in the amendment.
Senate File 2, third reading amendment number 2, delete, and then page 2, line 5.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. President, I move.
You're good.
Mr. President, I move third reading amendment number 2 to Senate File 2 and ask for the body's favorable consideration. Mr. President, I think I listened to the debate, I think, rather intently, and the concern was whether or not this could be abused, especially abused during the off part of time, and that's why we had the Management Council in there. However, I did want to provide some mechanism with some sideboards during the time of when we're not in session. And so this amendment, the meat of it actually deals with what happens when we're not in session. And let me start in the top and we'll get to that part. On page 2, line 5, we insert legislative committee after legislator, and then on page 2, line 9, we delete either branch of the legislature and insert any legislator, legislative committee, or legislative body in accordance, when in session, in accordance with the rules. So when in session, it's in accordance to the rules. You can have a committee, a legislator, or either legislative or both legislative bodies can request a AG's opinion. Then we go down and we actually Christmas tree the provisions in subsection C, and so we say when the legislature is not in session, the Management Council, by a majority vote of the members of each House present, In Romanet 1, Romanet 2, we say a joint interim committee by a majority vote of the members of each House present. Mr. President, I think it's important to, there's a couple of concepts there. I say each House present because necessarily I don't want the House overrunning the Senate and asking for an AG's opinion if it doesn't have the support of the senators on that committee, whether it's a management council or whether it's an interim committee. I think it's important to bring in the interim committees because they have specific expertise in all matters that we deal with in the legislature. And with that vote standard by both houses, that's a very high bar to ask for an AG's opinion. And I think that mechanism in and by itself is going to reduce the amount of what you may characterize as a frivolous AG request. And it also allows the participation of every elected body or every elected legislator to the body in the House and the Senate as far as inputs as to whether or not there should be a request in between the session times for an AG's opinion. So it's fairly restrictive, I think, because you have to have the majority of both houses. It's an interim committee, Mr. Chairman. It's by the rules that's going to be set up by both houses. And they'd have to be, Mr. Chairman, joint rules because they're joint interim committees. So you're going to have both houses agree as to the structure as far as the particulars of when we ask for a AG's opinion. So I think this gets right to the heart of some people who had concerns of runaway requests for AG opinions, but it also gets to the concern that everybody on this floor and the floor in the other chamber can actually have an input into representing the constituents that elected them. So, Mr. Chairman, with that explanation, I would stand for questions, and I would hope that I'd have your favorable consideration.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to divide the amendment. Lines 1 through 9, I believe, and then 10 through 22, I think it's divisible.
Majority Leader, I'm just contemplating whether the Division 2 stands alone without Division 1. Senator Meyer? On the issue of the division.
Yes, on the issue of the division, I'm not sure whether it is divisible because in this manner, because on line 5, we add in legislative committee, and then that concept is carried on in the second part of the division, so that I'm not sure whether it's divisible or not, Mr. Chairman, in that manner. It may be divisible, but I don't think in that line. I'm sure that, Mr. President, you could figure out how to divide that if the intent is to take out committee, but I'm not sure what the intent of the maker of the motion was, but I think in this manner, I don't believe it is divisible. Is that right?
Right.
Majority Plurality Senator Hicks on the issue of the division.
Mr. President, on the issue of the division, I believe the first...
Pull your mic towards you, please.
Mr. President, on the issue of the first division, I believe it's out of order, lines 1 through 2. As presented, the division was lines 1 through 9. Lines 1 through 2, that amendment was defeated, which makes that division out of order. I believe that division would have to be 4 through 9.
Senator Hicks, since that amendment, that's just superfluous language, which we do. It's irrelevant because the amendment was defeated. So that's not the issue. The issue that I'm having a difficult tracking is, frankly, I'm having a hard time tracking the entire amendment, but I believe that lines 11 through 22 will not stand on their own because the line on the second division, you begin on page 2, line 12, you delete the language, the entire language. On line 13, you delete when, and then you delete the semicolon. Senator Meyer.
When it's before when, you delete legislature. So it would read when the legislature is not in section, in session, Romanet 1 and 2.
Okay. The chair then determines that it is divisible. And so division number 1 is lines 1 through 9. Division number 2 is lines 11 through 22. We're on division number 1. Lines 1 through 9. Discussion on division number 1. There being no discussion, further discussion, the question is, third reading amendment number 2, division 1, to Senate file 2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That's been adopted. We're now at division number 2, lines 11 through 22. Discussion on amendment number, division number 2 to Senate file number, or third reading amendment number 2. Discussion, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. The reason I divided this amendment is I'm not sure maybe the sponsor could answer my question. If we allow, and I understand the intent of it, we have a majority vote of the members of each House present to do this. Is there any other unintended consequences? That's what I'm trying to track through, Mr. Chairman, if there are any, or if there are any unintended consequences by allowing an interim committee to have the same rights as the members of majority vote of the members of each House and each body. And I haven't been able to sort through that in my mind. Maybe the chair or the sponsor of this could give me some more input on that.
Senator, Mr. Minority Floor Leader, did you wish to, Senator Scott?
Mr. President, speaking on and for this amendment, Mr. President, it seems to me that you've got a reasonable compromise here that we aren't going to be as restrictive when we're out of session as saying it has to be the Management Council, but we aren't going to be as wide open as saying it has to be that any individual member can, because we all know that it's possible for in any human group of 90 for there to be one that gets carried away with something and puts an undue burden on the Attorney General. And I think the Attorney General really does need to start to be more responsive to requests from the legislature, and I think if he doesn't be responsive, maybe he doesn't need as many people as he has. But be that as it may, that's a separate issue. But here you have two sets of gatekeepers. One's the Management Council, but that's not in session very often. It's not accessible to many of us. The Joint Interim Committees are in session, are accessible, and can curb any excesses, but still give members reasonable access to getting opinions, and may well be that some of the opinions that get requested are things that are very relevant to the Interim Committee's work. I don't have strong feelings one way or the other about the language majority vote of the members of each House present. I suspect if it's a good request, everybody's going to be for it. And if it's out of line, very few people are going to be for it. So I don't think that language makes a lot of difference. It does make it marginally harder. But, Mr. President, I urge adoption of this amendment because I think it is a good compromise.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, on and for this division, but still with concern, and the concern goes back to some of the discussion that we had on second reading, and what it comes down to is the philosophy that this is more permissive, which is probably good. It creates more opportunities to have an AG opinion, but a lot of the time you would want an AG opinion is not when everybody is in agreement. This is a circumstance where you have everyone in agreement. You've got the entirety or the majority in this instance of two committees, which means that the majority party can have an opinion. The minority party in challenge would not be able to access an opinion. Or not even that circumstance, but a simple division of philosophy where the minority view may well be correct. And we know that's, in fact, often the case. I'm just going to pause there for a moment. I've got like 4 minutes. But under these circumstances and under this proposed statutory change, it doesn't matter if you're correct or if you have a valid or important opinion. It matters if you have a majority view, which honestly is seldom the time that you actually need the AG opinion. So while this is more permissive, and I'm going to support this amendment, it does not satisfy the concern of when you truly need access to an AG opinion, and that is oftentimes when you need an interpretation that is not the popular interpretation, but need an interpretation that might be reflecting a minority opinion, whether it's from the minority party or simply from a minority membership of either of the chambers. So on and for the amendment, but with concern.
Further discussion on the amendment? There being none, the question is on third reading amendment number 2, division number 2, lines 11 through 22. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That amendment has been adopted. As a result of your action, both divisions of third reading number 2, Senate File 2, have been adopted. We're now back on the bill. Senator Case.
Mr. President, thank you very much. I would urge us not to pass this bill. I'm thinking about what do we accomplish with this bill? Right now, there's sort of a rough balance, I guess, that's existed as we've developed our relationship with the executive branch and with the attorney general. Different attorney generals have kind of interpreted that balance to be different ways. But here we have, I think this what this bill actually does is cause us to limit ourselves. Certainly the original bill did. The amendment has made it better, but in my mind, it's not where the point where really if an individual, sometimes that minority that we've discussed and the good minority floor leader talked about, is only one person. And sometimes that one person is questioning the actions that happen here. I'll give a hypothetical. Supposing the budget bill was not constitutional, hypothetically speaking, and you protested that, and you needed a way to request an opinion about that. It's very hard to do when everybody else seems to think it's the right way to do things. So sometimes that minority is only one. And, Mr. President, the Attorney General can always say no. He can decide he doesn't want to do this. That's part of the kind of the tweaking between the two branches. And I think we should leave it like it is. And because without access, though, by individual legislators, we can't go to our county attorneys. like the other officials can. We don't have city attorneys. We have us. And sometimes what the majority does or what happens as a result of actions is not constitutional. And we may have concerns about that, and we need some help. We can't go engage a private attorney. That's really off the scale. And you just need to have this avenue open. I'd ask us to vote no on the bill.
Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. President. You know, folks, I don't think it makes a lot of difference whether the bill passes one way or the other. And because, as we was brought out on committee, the whole is that the AG doesn't work for us. The AG works for the governor and the agencies. And that we may very well have a valid issue as to constitutionality. But if it's contrary to what the executive branch wants, the AG needs to represent the executive branch, and the AG will do what the executive branch wants to have done. So essentially, we do not have an attorney general as far as the makeup, the procedures, the structure of the attorney general, that the attorney general cannot give an independent opinion because we do not have an independent AG. You would like to think that the AG was independent. In some circumstances, I think there is that degree of independence. But where conflicts the divisions, the agencies, and this was brought up, I think, by the tall senator from Natrona County, that there is that conflict. And it was brought up by several people on the floor. There is that conflict. So at some point in time, we need to have a frank discussion about how the executive branch is represented by legal counsel, how we're represented by legal counsel, and how the people in Wyoming are represented by legal counsel by establishing an independent AG. And I'm not saying an elected AG. Throw that out of the back of your hat. But there has to be a frank discussion about how that can happen. And so ask for an AG's opinion. You're likely to get something that you don't want to have back, especially if it's in conflict with the
law,
the executive branch. Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. Appreciate those comments. You know, one of the things that we have to understand, members of the Senate, is that that's already an existing law, that if we want to ask an opinion during a session, we can't do that. I mean, that's under existing law, and what we're trying to deal with is when we're not in session, just to afford us the same opportunities that we would have while we're in session, which is the whole reason we bring this to you. Most of the opinions that occur do not occur during a session. There are a lot of them that occur outside the session, so this provides some sideboards to be able to do that. If you don't pass this bill, we're back to where we are, where sure, during the session, we can ask for Attorney General's opinion. And my colleague from Goshen County, everything he said stands firm and is the reality of the equation of the situation, but at least we have the opportunity to do it when we're not in session. So I would ask you to support the bill.
Any further discussion on the bill? Senator Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. On and against Senate File 2. Mr. President, I started off supporting this legislation when it was in the Management Council and when we sponsored it, and the more I've heard the debate and the discussion about it, the more I really am concerned with the limitations that this puts on the rank-and-file member of the Senate and the way that it provides unintended limitations. And I don't think there was an intent on the limitation, but I do think that the result is a limitation on the Senate members and House members of just being that minority of one and being able to have access to the Attorney General and to make a request. The returning to the way things are right now, while not explicit and clear, do provide the access and provide a customary tradition where it really is up to the Attorney General whether or not they want to take something on and provide an opinion. which is a reasonable process. It's not to say it's a perfect process, but it's reasonable. Their discretion is what is then involved. If we get to a circumstance where we have motions and majorities and have a body making the decision, then we get into a circumstance where we end up grading our own homework effectively. If we pass a piece of legislation 1 year, that means the body found it constitutional. That's why we passed it. It seems pretty unlikely then that you would have a majority of a body the next year saying, well, you know what, let's get an AG opinion on that because we find it unconstitutional. It's already passed by a majority. So you don't have the check and balance on the constitutionality that you might request, require, or need to carry out the operations of government and to keep our checks and balances in place. So Senate File 2 is well intended. I was there when we were working this legislation. There was no interest in limiting out access and doing it in a way that precludes proper process and assurance of getting an accurate AG opinion on the constitutionality of matters. But in the end, this does not accomplish the objective that I think we set forth towards. I think it will lead to a chilling of access to the AG, a redefinition of that minority legislator who really does need some expert opinion and barring them out. So I would ask the body to resist this. Perhaps we can revisit it later. There's been discussion about trying to really clarify some of these relationships and obligations. I don't think this is a piece of legislation that's really ready to move forward to reflect the interests of that individual minority or a small group of legislators that really just need an opinion on something that might be counter to an overwhelming majority of the legislature, regardless of the issue. It's not a partisan matter. It really is a matter of you have a minority opinion, you need to understand it better, and you need an avenue for that. And this precludes that avenue from taking place, Mr. President. So hopefully the body will resist it at this time.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, on and for the legislation. It does seem to me, Mr. President, we've got a reasonable compromise here that imposes a certain amount of discipline and yet allows members good access to be able to ask for an Attorney General's opinion. And a lot of the discussion, debate, Mr. President, has been in terms of constitutional issues. I have a suspicion that a good part of the time, the question will need not be a constitutional one. It will be, what does this statute really mean? What does it mean as applied to a particular set of circumstances that we're starting to see arise? Because we do encounter, as we do our work, and particularly some of the interim committee work, questions where we look at the statute and say, well, okay, well, what's really the implication of this statute? It appears to be ambiguous. How would it be applied? Do we need to write legislation that clarifies it? And having an Attorney General's opinion as to what the thing the book before us really means, I think could be quite useful in a number of circumstances. So I think it's important that we do have this opportunity, and I think the way we've structured it now is workable. And I think it does keep the privilege can be abused because, after all, the legislature is 90 people, and we are representative as the public as a whole, and it certainly is possible that without this structure, one member, or maybe even two members, might request more than is reasonable and put an unreasonable workload on our Attorney General. So I would urge adoption of the bill.
Mr. Vice President, would you please approach the bench? Any further discussion? Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, in on and against the bill, and I have to reiterate something that the good senator from Natrona County, more times than not, these opinions are not constitutional issues. They're not majority versus the minority opinions. They're clarifications in the law, and I'll give you a couple examples. on at least one occasion, and maybe two, I've had to ask for an attorney general's opinion, because sometimes the laws are a little bit ambiguous, and sometimes the laws have a hierarchical. So which one trumps the other one within the statute? So I've done those on behalf of constituents. And they've come to me and they said, well, we're not clear on exactly what the law is. And they bring it to me and I read it, not being a lawyer, but still looking at it and say it is ambiguous and it's not clear to me. As a legislature, I'm not exactly clear what the law says. You're going to have these situations where your constituents at some point in time need some clarification. If you adopt this legislation, you've just taken that opportunity away from you. How are you adequately going to serve the constituents when they come to you with a problem in statutes that is either ambiguous, unclear, or has competing statutes and trying to figure out which one of these presides over the other one? Now you're going to have to go to a standing committee. Again, I applaud the attempts here, but I think it just goes a little bit far. I think we need to continue this discussion. So don't limit your ability to service your constituents. That's what this does. If we've got some issues, we need to address those. But I think this is the wrong vehicle at this time.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. Ladies and gentlemen, on and for the bill for a little bit different reasons. I think the debate that we're having is beginning to hone down, and you're beginning to see what the issues are. And we had promised to provide you the opinion that sort of generated this interest. And I apologize. As I said here today, I don't think that got distributed. I will get it out, and I apologize. But when you begin to look at the decision that was the refusal to provide an opinion by a member of the legislature on a constitutionality issue, my recollection without having in front of it is there were really two issues that the Attorney General looked at. One was the statute didn't require him to provide the opinion because, as pointed out by the majority floor leader, the statute currently says you can only request opinions during session. So there's a limitation there, and that became a refuge not to provide the opinion all. He said, I'm not required to. The other element gets into the honing of the issues that you've described that's beginning to get formulated, but it goes like this. The Attorney General, if you go and ask him for an opinion of a constitutionality, has an inherent conflict of interest because he's required to uphold the laws, all the laws of the legislature. We have a statute that's being challenged now in court that we're addressing. Even if he believes that statute has fundamental issues, he's still required to enforce that law because that's his role. The executive branch enforces our laws, and it's up to the court to determine whether it's constitutionality. The time for the Attorney General to exercise his opinion with respect to unconstitutionality is after the bill is passed, before he makes a recommendation to the governor to veto the bill or not. But once that becomes law, it's his job to enforce it, whether he agrees with it philosophically or not. Among ourselves as a legislature, the Attorney General is not the person to whom an individual says, I don't like what happened in the collective body. I'm going to run down and ask for an opinion that all my colleagues are passing unconstitutional law. That's not your prerogative, nor is that your role. Your role is to debate here. And the Attorney General is not a hammer for any individual member to run down to say, I don't like what my colleagues did. Would you please rule that what they did is unconstitutional? Our colleague from the tall senator from Natrona County has it right on when he says the general purpose for asking for opinions is to determine what the status of the law with how it's likely to be interpreted. And in that sense, when the Attorney General renders an opinion, It is persuasive in court, and that's about its level of persuasiveness. It's persuasive to court that the Attorney General of the State of Wyoming provided an opinion. Certainly you can rely on it, and you would not be at injury that you are working against advice of counsel. So in that area, I think the bill is moving forward on the right track. We've enlarged the capacity of access for those opinions, but we've also approached a way to regulate the amount of work because the Attorney General is not staffed up to do all of our work. So I'd urge you to vote for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Any further discussion on the amendment or on the bill itself? There being none, the question having been called for, excuse me, Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, members of the Senate, I've been all over the board on this bill ever since we started out with it. And the one thing, though, I've been trying to wrestle with in my mind, I guess more than anything else, is, and I've heard this maybe a couple of different times, but it appears to me that in this document that the President was talking about earlier that came from the AG's office, if I remember correctly, basically saying, you know, if you don't do something about this, you know, basically when you're out of session, we're not going to accept any request for an opinion. And if that's the case, we're kind of locked out of the system totally. And it sounded like to me that there was a system where this was worked out, whereby the management council said, okay, then if you won't accept, and I don't mean to be putting words in the mouth of the management council, and I apologize for that, but this is what I've gone through in my mind, that, okay, if we don't do something about this, Attorney General basically is going to say, when you're not in session, I'm not going to accept any requests for opinions. You're just locked out. I will accept them because of the law during the session, but nothing when you're out of session. And so that's what kind of I've been wrestling with this whole time, trying to be sure that's actually where we're at on this.
Question.
Further discussion? There being none, and the question having been called for, will the Chief Clerk please call the roll on Senate File number 2?
Anderson?
Aye.
Aye. Barnard?
No.
No. Bebout?
Aye.
Boner?
Aye.
Aye. Burns?
No.
No. Case?
No.
No. Christensen? Aye. Co?
Aye.
Aye. Cooper?
No.
No. Kraft?
No.
Dockstetter?
No.
No. Driscoll?
No.
No. Emmerich?
Aye.
Aye. Escobel?
No.
No. Geis?
Aye.
Aye. Hastert?
No.
Hicks?
No.
No. Johnson?
Aye.
Aye. Kinski?
No.
No. Landon?
Aye.
Aye. Meyer?
Aye.
Aye. Pappas?
Aye.
Aye. Perkins?
Aye.
Aye. Peterson?
No.
No. Ross?
Aye.
Aye. Rothfuss?
No.
No. Scott?
Aye.
Aye. Von Fladern?
Aye.
Aye. Wasserberger?
Aye.
President Nicholas?
Aye.
Aye. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 17 aye, 13 no.
Senate File 2 having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members of the legislature elected to the Senate, Senate File 2 has passed the Senate. Senate File 36, Senator Case.
Mr. President, without objection, I'd like to lay Senate File 36 back one more day while I get a quick Attorney General's opinion about it.
Good luck with that. Senate File 36. The request was to lay it back for additional day. If there's no objection, there being no objection, Senate File 36 is hereby laid back for an additional day for third reading. Do we have any more work? We have a report. We have reports from the House. Reports from standing committee.
February 16, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporations, to whom was referred Senate File 100, Special Districts Emergency Medical Services, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Case, Hicks, Meyer, Pappas, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Senate File number 12, Vietnam War Commemorative, has an appropriation. I ask that it be re-referred to Committee number 2, Appropriations.
Without objection, Senate File number 12 is re-referred to Committee number 2, Appropriations. That clear the desk. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business of bills on General File, Committee of the Whole.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. And for members of the Senate, it's the intent of your Majority Floor Leader to come in at 9 o'clock, probably the rest of the week. We've got a lot of work ahead of us, so just plan on that. And with that, Mr. President, I move the Senate resolve itself and Committee of the Whole to discuss bills on General File.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, no. That motion has been adopted. Senator Von Fladern. Committee of the Whole will come to order. First bill for our consideration is Senate File 9. Will the clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 9, Railroad Quiet Zones, sponsored by the Transportation Committee, an act relating to railroad quiet zones. It was referred to Committee number 8, Transportation, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Boner, Emmerich, Esquivel, Johnson, and Meyer. Senator Meyer, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee number 2, Appropriation, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Meyer, you've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee, the whole, rise and report it, do so with a do-pass motion on Senate File number 9, Railroad Quiet Zones. Essentially, Mr. Chairman, this bill does two things. It extends the sunset date of a existing program, and it also provides for a reduction in the match required, and it does so in a manner that takes the 5%, goes to 2% for the bottom poorest seven counties, for the middle eight counties from 25 to 13, and for the counties which have the greatest ability to pay from 50% to 30% match, Joint Appropriations Committee did have an amendment. I'd ask that amendment be read in at this time and would defer to the good Senator of Appropriations to explain the amendment.
Member of the reading clerk, please read an amendment.
Senate File 9, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 9.
That's Senator Meyer, that would be your amendment from a standing committee?
No, that's Senator Ross's.
You've got to take this one first.
Which one's
this? This has nothing to do with money.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chairman. We do have a standing committee amendment, Mr. Chairman. And essentially, you go to page 2, line 9, it deletes counties and inserts the sponsoring governmental entity. And on page 9, line 4, this was, I believe, a good catch by our new senator from Converse County. A little cleanup there to take effectively and use the right word, effective. So I would ask that has been read in, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, it has.
And I would stand for questions. If there are none, I'd ask for call for the question.
Any conversation any on Standing Committee Number 1, Senate File 9? Seeing none, all in favor of Senator Meyer's motion on Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 9, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? That has passed the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I think the good Senator from Appropriations is on board.
Okay. Senator Ross.
Chairman, I would move second reading amendment number 9, standing committee amendment number 2, and ask that it be read in.
Reading clerk, please read it in.
Senate File 9, standing committee amendment number 2, page 3, line 12.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I have moved the amendment, in essence, what occurred in Joint Appropriations Committee, as a good sponsor of the bill and Joint Transportation Committee Chairman explained, that right now there's about $2.7 million in this account, and quite frankly, not all of it's been used. And quite frankly, as the testimony was, there's a number of communities that have just decided not to access those funds. And so what the amendment does, pursuant to the request of the chairman from transportation, was to leave in $1.6 million. That's on page 3, line 12. And in essence, will recapture to the general fund $1.1 million. And then there's some additional language on page 3, line 17, that says, any amounts in the account in excess of $1,600,000 and any additional funds not obligated by a letter of intent from a participating governmental entity with identified matching funds by January 1, 2017 shall revert to the budget reserve account immediately. So what we wanted to do, and what I believe this amendment does, is say, okay, look, there's some communities, and you had a handout on your desk that showed some that were very much interested in these railroad quiet zones, but this is a process that sometimes takes some time. Sometimes there's some problems with the railroad themselves, but we wanted to make sure that those funds, that additional 1.6, if they don't have a letter of intent and a commitment to those funds by January 1, those funds would then be available in the supplemental budget for use by this body. So that's the amendment, and I'd urge your favorable consideration.
Any discussion on Standing Committee Number 2 to Senate File 9? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I did bring forth these numbers to our Appropriations Committee. I think it's the old appropriation member in me that identified the possibility of using this money, and the committee, I think, did a good job to make sure that if a community has that intent and shows it by basically January of next year, they can go ahead with this project. If not, then we could maybe claw back some other funds and use that in our supplemental budget. I think the Appropriation Committee did a good job. I ask for your support.
Any further discussion on Standing Committee Number 2's amendment to Senate File 9? Seeing none, are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Ross's motion to adopt the second reading amendment to Senate File 9, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate Amendment Number 2 has passed the Committee of the Whole. And we have another amendment. If Senator Perkins, would the reading clerk please read in the Committee of the Whole Number 1 amendment?
Senate File 9, Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 12.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 9 and ask the body vote aye. Members of the Senate, what you've got with Senate File 9 is a continuation of a program that kind of was started back in, 2009, and ultimately in 2011, the legislature appropriated and put into the budget the circumstances and the requirements under which people would enjoy the benefits or communities could enjoy using some of these appropriated money to help with railroad quiet zones. There's been 9 or 10 or so communities that have done that and did it under the old regime, and there's been probably a 20 to two dozen communities that just haven't had any interest. There remains about 5 small communities, one kind of northeastern, north central part of the state, another one in northern central part of the state, and then 3 kind of on the eastern side of the state. And what this amendment does is this puts the bill as it came to you actually reduced the program and the matching requirements for various communities. And what this amendment does is put it back to the way they were in the original bill. And the thought process behind that is simply that all the communities that took part in this and did it before had to meet the matches of 5%, 25%, and 50%. The bill came in and had reduced those percentages for the participating communities to 2%, 13%, and 30%. What this amendment does is simply put it back so that they're playing under the same rules that everybody else played under and when they did these programs in the past. And ask for your favorable consideration.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment 1. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you give and you give and you give to appropriations, and they come back and they want more. Mr. Chairman, we're the first one where we came up with $1.1 million. I think this is maybe going a little bit too far. These communities, most of them are extremely small communities. If you look at the amount of money that they get in our grants back from the state, maybe it's $10,000, maybe it's $20,000. We're talking about something that's going to cost somewhere around $500,000. And so when you move those prices up or that match up, then it just takes it out of the ballpark. You know, so I would hope that we would resist this. We came up with another $1.1 million. We structured an amendment that we may be able to claw back some coming into the next supplemental budget. I think we're at a reasonable spot here, and I would ask for the body's support on this to resist this amendment.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment 1. Seeing none, are you ready for the question? Oh, sorry. Didn't see Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. On against the amendment,
or at least the first portion of it, with respect to the smaller communities, moving them from, and the least well off of our brethren, moving them from two up to five, they're going to struggle to make the two. Sheridan was the first community in the state of Wyoming to have a quiet zone, and we were fortunate to be able to fund that entire cost out of our optional 1 cent tax. These smaller communities don't necessarily have that option, and I'd like to see this defeated. Maybe we can come back on a subsequent reading and look at an amendment that just amends it, leaves the smaller communities whole. Thank you.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment 1. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I mean, sure, you can do that. It's state money. You can act like it's other people's money. But it ultimately, there are a number of communities that took advantage of this, some who are poor and some who are small, and they came up with the program. I mean, we want to come back to the amendment, and they don't have to do any match. But if these are small communities and they're doing that, you're looking at a 5% match for most of these communities. It might be one or so that might have to come up with a higher match. But at the end of the day, everybody else who participated in this program had to meet these same requirements. So maybe the rule is if you just wait long enough that the hearts get soft and you'll give it to them and they can just have it. So we could also have an amendment to just take away no match and just let them have it. So you voted up, voted down, but that's what we're doing here.
Further discussion, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, could we divide this amendment and line 1 and 2 would be first and 3 through 8 would be second?
Is it a motion to divide? Division 1 is lines 1 through 3. Is that correct, Senator?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Division 1 is lines 1 through 3. Division 2 is lines 4 through 8.
Yes.
Any discussion on Division 1? Senator Anderson, do you have anything? Further discussion? All in favor, all those in favor of Senator Anderson's motion on Division 1? Yes. All those in favor of Senator Anderson's motion on Division 1 should pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
That division has failed. We're on Division 2, lines 4 through 8. Anybody have any discussion on Division 2? All those in favor of Senator Anderson's motion to adopt Division 2 of Committee of the Whole Amendment to Senate File 9, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
Chair is in doubt. Would those in favor of Division 2, Committee of the Whole Amendment to Senate File 9, please stand. Those in favor, please stand. Those opposed to Division 2, Committee of the Whole 1 for Senate File 9, please stand. Those opposed. Division 2 has failed. We're back on the bill. Senator Meyer, you may.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, with us today from the great town of Tarrington, Wyoming, we have Mrs. Walsh's Trail Elementary class. Are those guys still back there, Mrs. Walsh? Would you please stand up, and would the Senate please help me welcome them to the Senate?
Welcome to the Senate.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, we're back on the bill. Any further discussion on Senate File 9? Question haven't been called. All those in favor of Senator Meyer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises report that to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 9, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
Senate File 9 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration is Senate File 68. Would the reading clerk please read it in?
Senate
Senate File 68, Budget Shortfall Measures, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee, an act relating to administration of government. Was referred to Appropriations Committee number 2, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Burns, Hastert, Perkins, Ross, and Wasserberger. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Ross, you've heard the reading. What is your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee hold rise and report it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 68, Budget Shortfall Measures. There is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Will the reading clerk please read it in?
Senate File 68, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 6, line 19.
Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that standing committee amendment and refer the matter to the good Vice President of the Senate for discussion not only of the bill, but the Standing Committee Amendment.
Mr. Vice President, it's all yours. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, what I'll do is I'll take you through the bill, and when we get to the part, we get to page 6, we'll deal with the Standing Committee Amendment
That'll be appropriate.
Thank you. So what we have is budget shortfall measures. Newsflash, body, if you haven't heard about it, the purse is getting tight in Wyoming. So what we've got here before you is a series of budget fall measures. Some of these have kind of been done informally in the past. Some of these have been in budget. Some of these concepts have been in budget bills in the past. And again, trying to make sure or to get away from substantive law in a general appropriations bill, we bring this bill is brought to you in that context. So all we do, I'll just take you through the process fairly quickly. Which is sort of starting on page 2 when we have this budget for shortfall measure. First of all, the governor does a review of the budgets and the money that's coming in. And ultimately, if he makes a determination that there's going to be a budget shortfall, then he starts to look at how do we cover the shortfall. We do it by appropriations, by ability to transfer money. Transferring that money could potentially come from anywhere, including capital construction projects, and it starts to look like that. So once he gets through that process, then any appropriated amount is reduced pursuant to the governor moving this money around to cover it, or if the governor otherwise determines that there's a shortfall in the appropriated funds likely at any time in the fiscal biennium prior to the session of the legislature, then the governor can take the following actions. First thing he can do is he can notify the chairman of the Joint Appropriations Committee, Management Council, and JAC and Craig, and they can start to look at that. If you go to page 4, the next thing you know, the Management Council forwards the legislature's proposals and recommendations to the governor and council reassign out to various standing committees the ability to look at and look at how we accomplish or meet budget shortfall measures, which could be either through raising revenue or cutting expenses. Number 3, the Joint Appropriations Committee goes to work and finds out if there's contingent appropriations or other offsets or other things that be taken into consideration in managing the budget shortfall. Then you get down to several items that the Joint Appropriations can consider. They can look at reductions. They have to examine how long do they anticipate the period of decline will last to see how you do that. They can look at the availability of other existing or projected funds to offset any shortfall that might come in. They also the amount of time before the next regular or legislative session when they can deal with that, and also the percentage of the contingent appropriation needed to be used to ensure that a budget shortfall will be alleviated until either the end of the fiscal biennium or when the legislature can convene and solve those issues. Then they submit those recommendations within 30 days back to the governor, who then starts to, after receiving the recommendation, the governor can then authorize transfer of contingent appropriation and start to go through work on some of that. Some other things happen. If you turn to page 6, which also deals with our amendment, we talk in the consensus revenue estimating group. This now puts into statute what that is and how it's appointed and where those folks come from and what their criteria should be. Now we have the consensus revenue estimating group, or CREG, as we often call it, has been usually in the budget bill. This now puts it into statute. It's been in session laws, but this will now be in codified law. And so that brings us to the amendment. What the amendment does is it makes sure that the CREG and its deliberations, and until it issues a report, are exempt, are not subject to the public meetings requirement. And the purpose of that is it's not quite like the Fed, Mr. Chairman, but it is a little bit. As the CREG makes its forecasts, if anybody has advanced knowledge of what those forecasts will be and what the numbers up or down will be, it could potentially create a competitive advantage and for people to deal with those things if they have that information early. And so that's what the Standing Committee Amendment does, is would exempt the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group, or CREG, from having to disclose that information early and have that. Also, hopefully, it will also insulate them from public pressures to either decrease or increase their forecasts. That'll take care of my explanation on the Standing Committee Amendment and ask for its favorable approval if we want to vote on that now, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment number 1? Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question on this Standing Committee Amendment. Wondering if there was much of a discussion or any public input during the committee meeting on this one.
Senator Ross Perkins. Senator Perkins?
If are you talking about the amendment or just the putting the consensus CREG group into statute?
It'd have to be the amendment, if that's what your question was.
Mr. Chairman, on the amendment,
yeah.
The group shall not be subject to public meeting requirements. I was just curious what kind of feedback, if any, we've received on that yet.
Okay.
Senator Perkins?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the initial feedback received on it was questioning whether or not we should put CREG in statute. And so the initial feedback was whether or not you would even have page 6, the new section 9-2-1014.3, to even have that in statute. The committee looked at that, and you go back and you find it in non-codified law. You find it in the session laws over and over and over. And so ultimately we thought that, again, trying to get out of these things where we have substantive law in the budget statute, we should put it in the budget statute. So then, Once we determined that maybe that it should be in statute, then the next question is should individuals be able to attend their deliberations, attend their work, and also have access to the records that they have, at least prior to the time that they publish their reports? From when they do their work and publish a report, there's usually about a week to 2 week lag in the time that they do the report. That they do their work and have their meeting and meet and make their conclusions to the time the report's issued. And so the concern was to not let anybody get a head start prior to the time that the report was released. I think that's about the extent of our discussions on this issue.
Further discussion on Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 68? Seeing none, are you ready for the question? Oh, sorry. You're sitting in the dark over there. I couldn't really see you.
Oh,
Senator
the dark side.
Floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate. On the amendment, there was quite a bit of discussion and concerns raised about the open meetings and then also open documents laws and requirements by codifying them in law. And you know, it was determined that through discussion that it was best to codify the CREG group, but that in fact that the fact that they talk, that their deliberations are on sensitive and many times proprietary information, it was a concern about them having the same effectiveness and being able to deliberate without with, you know, having their meeting subject to open meeting. So there's another amendment coming up on this that actually goes a little bit further on advice to staff that maybe that we didn't quite cover all that was necessary for Craig. So it was, you know, definitely discussed extensively on that point.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion as I look around both rooms. Question being called on. That would be Senator Ross's motion. All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion to adopt the Standing Committee number 1 to Senate File 68, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed the body. We have a committee of the whole number 1. If somebody would like to address that, Senator Perkins.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to do that at that time, or do you want to continue through the explanation of the bill?
I think we can continue with the explanation. No call.
7, we talk about, on the bottom of page 6, top of page 7, we create a 1% severance tax account. What that is to take the 1% severance tax that would otherwise, the statutory that goes into the PMTF, and it intercepts that when there's a budget shortfall so that it's not, it doesn't go into the, it intercepts it from going to the permanent trust fund where it would otherwise be inviolate. So it holds that so that we can deal with that, and that's the statutory diversion, not the constitutional diversion. Then you start into, that completed the new section, so then we start into the sections of existing statutes that are modified. Some are, Mr. Chairman, are simply conforming, some are not. The idea is that when you go to the bottom of page 9, we talk about starting the series of definitions, which we're using those. We talk about the standard budget. It's already in statute. We expand that to reflect, since we're talking about these things, that reflect and identify any reductions that are, to appropriations made under the new statutes we just talked about. The standard budget would be reduced by any amount transferred from contingent appropriations so that any contingent appropriations will automatically increase the standard budget. And then we define the term budget shortfall. You can read it there. We define the term contingent appropriation so that you know what we're doing there, since we're using those terms in the document. We also identify the structural budget deficit, which is intuitive as it should sound. It simply means that you're looking at traditionally available revenue sources and comparing those against the appropriations for general operations, which are think generally are very similar to the standard budget, and then when the differential, then it would be the structural deficit, essentially. That's a little bit abbreviated. There you go. Then, since we've talked about traditionally available revenue sources, we're identifying those. Those are ones that we anticipate coming in on at least some form of reoccurring basis. May not be permanently reoccurring, but at least over a period of time. Then we come back in on page 11. Provided some instructions to the auditor who's in charge of the disbursing agent for the state in that capacity to make sure that they're applied in determining whether the expenditure exceeds an appropriation or other funds, which is one of the duties of the state of the auditor before approved and paid by the treasurer. So then also then there you see, since we've talked about and not given the governor authorization to deal with the contingent appropriation, we're providing him that power there on the bottom of page 11. Then you talk about use of flex authority, which is under one of the new sections we did. It's the flex authority for the governor to move between budget units and different classifications so that they can smooth out the budget shortfall. Then you get down to the bottom of the duties of the budget division, specifying some additional duties there with respect to the new statutes we've created and the budget shortfall measures. I think on page 13, 14, I think as you go through that, those are existing statutes. You get to there might be a conforming amendment in there, one or two. Then you get back to the page 16 with adding new language for these folks that making sure that the contingent appropriation is not included in an estimated source of revenue or funds available unless those funds have been previously authorized to be expended within the fiscal period covering the budget period for the recommendation. Again, what you're talking there is as you're moving money around trying to deal with a shortfall, trying to make sure that that doesn't go into the standard budget and become part of the standard budget automatically. Then
then there's some prohibitions on what the transfer of funds and the contingent appropriation are. We're dealing with those on the bottom of page 16. And then there's some direction to the governor with respect to when he submits a budget. So now there's some additional issues for when he submits the budget, so to help the legislature and help agencies and indeed the executive deal with the budget shortfall. Then there's, you see A, B, and C there, which are talking about as he makes his budget recommendations to identify those things to help everybody understand and keep a handle on what we're doing here with respect to anticipated budget shortfalls and how we're meeting them. And so we do that. Then once it's submitted, then the joint appropriations comes through and does exactly what we've done in the past. You'll identify, if they do it, they'll look at specific or general budget reductions. They'll look at immediate contingent appropriations that would be effective immediate, or they'll look at rent and ben expenditures of funds from the LSRA. They'll look at temporary redistribution of revenue streams, such as capturing the 1% diversion. That's an example of a redistribution of a temporary redistribution of a revenue stream. And then there's making, as you go into the budget, we're doing the same types of forecasting we did and the same types of things we did as if we were analyzing the budget shortfall, which is look at how long we anticipate the deficit last, look at the funds that are available in the LSRA, look at the services that would be affected, look at constitutional requirements, look at the ability to restructure programs to available revenues, look at the current forecasted short-term and long-term economic trends, and recommended depletion rates of expendable funds based upon what's the appropriate amount of spend rate on those types of things. Those are all things we do now, but these now will codify those and put those in statute. Then what you're doing there on the bottom of page 20 is you're intercepting any fund amounts. This will be under the 5%, which is the spending policy amount, I believe, in the Permanent Trust Fund. Again, you're looking to make sure that those things, if we're in a budget shortfall, that with some of the automatic mechanisms and rollovers and things like that, that those are intercepted or delayed until the legislature has a chance to look at those. And then also then there's some clarifying and conforming amendments with respect to severance tax distributions in the same way, again, dealing with the structural shortfall. So it's a bill that sets in some things that have been done in the past. Some of them we haven't had to worry about for a number of years because life's been pretty good in Wyoming for about a decade and a half or so, and now we come to a little bit tougher times. It's how do we deal with and address those things when they come up when we're not in session, and once we're here, how do we address those? So with that, we'll stand for further questions, and we can also deal with the other amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions or discussion on Senate File 69 before we move to the amendment, Senator Hicks? 68, excuse me. Senator Hicks? I think.
Mr. Chairman, just a question and to help me out. And where we're creating the 1% severance tax account, just a little explanation as to why we couldn't use one of the existing accounts that we have, either LESRA or the BRAR, to have those diversions go into those and then come out of that. So just trying to understand in my mind why we bypass those and why we're creating a new account would be helpful.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, before we get into the whole debate here, I've got the other part of the Trail Elementary here. This is Mrs. Orr's class from Trail Elementary in Tarrington. And would you please help me welcome them to the Senate?
Hooray! Yeah!
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Welcome to the Senate. And who wants to answer that last question? Senator Perkins?
The reason we did that was simply for transparency. Ultimately, if it was a temporary situation, you wanted to make sure that's the 1% severance that would otherwise be going into the Permanent Trust Fund. And so you're holding it there to make sure everybody understands what that is, and so that it's just a method of transparency so everybody understands what that is and where it came from. And so when we make decisions about that, the concept is simply that it'll be deliberate, that we understand exactly what we're doing with that 1% severance.
Mr. President.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. An additional benefit to doing that is in the definition of what you describe as the structural deficit. So what's happening here is that the we're not repealing the 1% statutory diversion into the permanent mill trust fund. What the bill does say is that when we declare these events of hardship, the JAC can recommend in a budget bill that's only good for 2 years a temporary diversion of those funds. By diverting them to a separate holding account within the general fund, so it's essentially another account, it's all in the general fund, but they're a separate holding account, for the definitional purposes, what it means is that your definition of your structural deficit remains your general fund and budget reserve. So we're not calling these and categorize them as ongoing revenues, even though they are. And the purpose of that is to try to hold our structural deficit at a level that these always become a parachute of monies for assistance. I submit to you that once the money goes in the general fund and you raise your structural, you treat those as ongoing revenues, your structural deficit will raise, the parachute's gone all forever. So there's a sound justification for always trying to say these funds, what we'd really like them is to build the corpus of the trust fund so that our investment earnings will grow. We need to have that corpus grow proportionally to our spending so that we can always hit 26% to 30% of our total revenues from investment earnings. If you don't do that, you just compound your structural deficit. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion, Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. If I could take us back to page 6, I just had a couple of questions, having not been here quite as long as some of those on appropriations and some in leadership. I guess my question revolves around what this actually changes. And then a follow-up to that is if we codify this and put the consensus revenue estimating group into statute like this, does that carry with it any strings, I guess? It just feels like to me, and this is just a gut feeling, but the minute you do this, especially given the amendment that we just passed, I just wonder if that puts us into a whole different sphere of what we've expected or how we've operated with the consensus revenue estimating group. If I'm correct, and I may not be, but it feels like that's been a little less formal group. And the minute you make that a little bit more formal, do we run the risk of that becoming more of a political arm, which I would not think that we would want to do that, but would appreciate any of the conversation that took place in committee to help me understand where we were and where this takes us. Thank you.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, historically, the Consensus Revenue Estimate Group was an ad hoc group that was developed between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And it simply was occurred because prior to that time, the executive branch would come in with its level of proposed expected earnings or revenues. And then the legislature said, well, we disagree. We don't think you're going to have that or you're going to have more. And so you had debate with respect to what was your revenues sources. So the group was created as this ad hoc group to resolve that issue and to have these at least two annual reviews of funding. When the JAC, or excuse me, when our staff went through to begin working on this bill, we see that the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group, the CREG group, has sifted into or come into statute. There's some like 4 or 5 references where it has been adopted in statutes in some way. So while it's an ad hoc committee, it has permeated into the statute. So the judgment call was, let's go ahead and define what it is because we need to be looking at it. And now, as we're giving the governor some capacity when we're out of session to pull certain triggers, and one of the triggers is activated by the result of the CREG group, you really do need to have some agreement with respect to what is that agreement. Now, the constitution of the group, and I mean by that the members of the group, are still ad hoc. The the executive gets the lion's share of the appointments, but the executive branch has traditionally conferred with JAC on their appointments. And you can see over time we've moved, what we've tried to do is find the most knowledgeable people and on the group. So you see a former budget officer of ours that's with the University of Wyoming. And the reason for that is because we just couldn't find anybody with the level of knowledge and experience that he had, and so we brought him into the group. You have economists, you have the Oil and Gas Commission, but occasionally you get new members coming through an agency, and so you shift them to experienced people. But as we're looking for these triggers to activate, now much of these, many of these remedies that you have in here are in our current bill and have been in our bills for a couple biennia. And one of the things that you're seeing, you're going to see is a series of bills trying to pull these often used and commonly adopted budget tools, if you will. We're taking them out and codifying them to reduce the size of the budget and to get a more an easier way to administer. It's intended to make it easier for everybody, set the rules. But in this case, we do need to attend to make sure that CRAIG remains an apolitical organization designed for collaboration between the executive branch and the legislative branch for expected revenues. If at any time we disagree with them, we're free to come in and say we don't agree with their revenue estimates and we're going to base our budgets on something else. But it's better if we have this consensus report. But as we begin to allow events to take place as a consequence to their estimates, then at some point you do have to introduce them in the statute. And we will see, we'll have discussion over the three readings as to how we protect the privacy of this group, make sure that they're able to collect information, not be lobbied, and remain apolitical.
Further discussion on Senate files. Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, and to the good senator from Natrona County's concerns. I had some further discussion with attorneys and the wisdom of putting them in codifying in statutes is sound. The fact that there could be challenges made in their work is taken care of to an extent by codifying. However, the protections that was advised, and if you look at, there's a coming amendment that kind of completely fills in the gaps. You know, what we did in committee was good, but it didn't quite go far enough. And by defining the intent codifying them in statute and then defining them, it was advised is the best way to allow them to continue to work the way they have been, simply because the amount of the work that they do, the sensitive nature, and, of course, the proprietary information. So it was advised that, in fact, putting them in statute is the best to protect and then better defining.
Thank you. Further discussion on Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd ask the committee if they did any future value analysis of investing that 1% in the PMTF under those standards that the Treasurer has and replacing the necessity for cash flow of LSRA funds, which at this point in time can't be invested in that manner. From my perspective, I think because of the correction that we've had in the market, if this money is taken away from the Treasurer, in 7 years you're going to lose more money than what you're gaining now in the flexibility with the spending of it today. That would be money ahead 7 years from now, maybe even a shorter time period, if we allow that money to be invested by the Treasurer and spend LSRA money. So my question is, has that analysis been done to see whether or not the future value of this, if you spend it today, is actually going to cost us money in the future?
Anybody like to answer Senator Meyer's question? Senator Perkins?
Thank you. No, we didn't talk about that. I mean, that's a great point. I think when you have to look at where you're at two things are going to happen, I think, as you look at that. First of all, when you look at the profile return on these things, only is about 2.1%. So over 7 years, assuming you earned nothing on it, which I think at the end of the day, you're probably still going to earn probably close to that, even holding it in the somewhere between 1 to 2%, you're going to earn that, whether it's in the permanent trust fund or whether it's not in the permanent trust fund because of a certain cash flow issues. The other thing happens, too, is when we talk about this, we're only, first of all, when this happens, it's only, that only happens when there's a budget shortfall. It doesn't happen all the time. It happens if you declare a budget shortfall, then that triggers into effect. So it doesn't automatically, it doesn't happen unless or until there's a budget shortfall. So this wouldn't be occurring. And if that's wrong, I'm sure I'll get corrected on that. But if you go back 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and this was in place, there wouldn't be anything accumulated in that severance tax account because there would not be a budget shortfall declared.
Further discussion before the Senator Hick?
Mr. Question, and kind of along those lines, so we're diverting that 1% statutory amount, but I see in here if we go to line 7, or page 7, and then you go down to lines 4 through 7, that once we've diverted these funds into this mineral severance attack, any interest on that then reverts to the general fund. And my question is, wouldn't that, if it stayed in the permanent mineral trust fund, wouldn't that interest generated stay in the permanent mineral trust fund and, in effect, trying to inflation-proof that account? And just a little bit of discussion on whether those interest earnings, that's the appropriate place to go is to the general fund.
Senator, Mr. President, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I guess in terms of our little bit and just what we're speaking about, in an ideal world when we started the permanent mineral trust fund, wouldn't it be nice that as you deplete your one-time resources, at the end of the day, the revenues off your permanent mineral trust fund would equal all the revenues that you receive on an ongoing basis from mineral extraction, so that one day you mine your last ton of coal, you pump your last barrel of oil, and your revenues off your PMTF now equal the amount of revenues you're receiving from minerals, so you build up one account to displace the other. That it would be a dream. We're so far away from there that it may be a dream, but it's something that's going to be beyond our lifetimes. In the meantime, when you look at the history of the revenues off the permanent mineral trust fund, if you begin to look at the 1990s as we're moving along, and I can get these numbers exactly, but my recollection is that we were making about 28% of our budget was paid for by earnings off the permanent mineral trust fund. As our expenditures went up, that ratio went down. And now as our revenues are declining, but our corpus has grown, they're going up. But the 28% is entirely a function of the earnings that you're making in the market at the time. With respect to the 1.5% diversion that we're speaking of, it was first put on, I believe, if we go back on the statute, but it was put on in the before the 19, or about the 1980s, at a time where there was a budget surplus, and they said we can now invest more into the permanent mineral trust fund. In the 90s, the statute was removed, and we lived in that environment until the 2000s, early 2000s, and shortly after that, as we began to develop deep gas in throughout Wyoming. And when we developed the deep gas sources, we said, look, it is time now to reinvest more of this money, and we reinserted that language. What we learn is that it's almost easier to, when you're in a revenue decline, it's easy to go in and say we have to have that money, and you remove the statute. And it's harder to put the statute back in place. But we know that these dollars were originally pledged, if you will, or they were anticipated to go into the general fund. So rather than wait and have the debate and then see hit a hardship and have the statute removed so that it's harder to put back in place, we said let's create an in-between. Let's leave the statutory diversions in place, but allow for temporary diversions through the budget, which would only be good for the budget period. And so the default is always that we reinvest. And reinvesting is important because it invokes the ideas of dollar cost averaging. You don't know exactly when to time the market, but we do know that if you consistently put money in, even if you have an environment where there are no capital gains, the person that puts in savings every day and dollar cost averages and buys into the market will in the long term benefit. And we know that when you put in the permanent trust fund that the earnings come back to us, but we also reinvest corpus for the future. And the account is managed not only for current beneficiaries but for future beneficiaries. Having said that, there will be and there are times when you simply need to have that revenue to either soften the blow or to cover the cost of government. And what this statute allows us to do is it creates that tool and prevents you from having that issue in the debate of whether or not we should just eliminate the statute, put the money in the general fund forever. It's a good compromise.
Further discussion, Senator Bevout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one other thing, too, that I think is really important when we talk about the revenues from the permanent trust fund. Back when we had the bust in the 80s and early 90s, you know, our general fund budget was a lot smaller than they relative to the amount of money and the earnings we got off the permanent fund. So it was about 25% of our budget. Today, that is down to 18%, which is why we tried to replenish and build up the permanent fund so we could get those revenues back up to 25%. Have not been able to do it, and that's another purpose for why we're trying to cover that shortfall this way.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have a few general concerns with the approach that this legislation takes. The idea is obviously one that we all, I think, recognize we need. We need to consider what the consequences of a shortfall in the future are going to be, how we handle that, what actions are taken. And we need to recognize, obviously, that we're not always in session and there has to be some type of authority in place to account for the circumstances where we're not in session, but we see a shortfall that has to be met. My concerns, though, Mr. Chairman, are the way that this is implemented is a desire to get to that system, but an unwillingness to actually give up any control when we're out of session in a manner that really does not solve the problems that we want solved. This still leaves everything in the hands of the Joint Appropriations Committee, despite the fact that the Joint Appropriations Committee really is only vested with power in that they're supposed to craft legislation and the budget and then bring it to this body, the entirety of this body, for passage as the executive branch, as the legislative branch, and then the executive branch is theoretically supposed to implement that. And my concerns start on page 5, gets at this concept, where we're looking at page 5 and we see in paragraph C and beyond this idea that the Joint Appropriations Committee is going to make recommendations. So that the governor, the executive branch, is faced with a situation, and the Joint Appropriations Committee is going to address that situation and the shortfall and make recommendations to the governor that he is supposed to wait upon. So there's a shall on the waiting, and then the presumption is that those recommendations will be taken into consideration and acted upon by the governor, which assumes that the Joint Appropriations Committee's recommendations are reflective of the will of the entire legislature, which may be the case. It may not be the case. But the Joint Appropriations Committee is not empowered to speak on behalf of the legislature or to act in an executive capacity. This legislation gives them that authority. It imbues them and embodies them with authority to speak on behalf of the legislature's interests authoritatively and make recommendations despite being only a subset of the legislature not acting in the legislative session. And I have concerns with that. It's certainly not consistent with the intent of the separation of powers. I believe it exceeds the capacity of what the Joint Appropriations Committee is supposed to do. And it's not written in a way where those recommendations are really supposed to be optional, but I recognize it also does not go quite as far as to say they're mandatory. I think it's written and crafted in a manner that is supposed to imply these are the steps that you should take without going that far in recognition of the separation of powers. So nice job drafting, but I think it still goes beyond the intent there. So from that standpoint, the Joint Appropriations Committee is still trying to stay in the process despite the fact that we're not in a legislative session, and I think that holds back what is needed in legislation that's supposed to adapt to a shortfall. This is further exacerbated on page 18 when we specifically go into what the Joint Appropriations Committee during a budget shortfall is allowed to do. So this series of paragraphs really gets at the idea of not only do we want to make sure that the Joint Appropriations Committee right now at the current time is in control of the budget, I think this goes to great lengths to make sure that the Joint Appropriations Committee that is embodied right now at this time is also in control of future budgets and what future Joint Appropriations Committees would be recommending, what they would be free to do, what their options on the table are by adding to statute provisions that theoretically guide the Joint Appropriations Committee and what actions they would be able to take or intend to take in the future. This is obviously not what we're supposed to be doing, and honestly, it's probably not going to stand up from the standpoint of a future legislature could simply overturn that, certainly, as they see fit. But the idea that we, the legislature, at this point in time, are going to tell a future Joint Appropriations Committee what they should and shouldn't do to address shortfalls in the budget seems inappropriate to me, and I would resist that. Not to say that I always agree with what the Joint Appropriations Committee comes up with, either at this time in the past or this future one is going to do any better from my standpoint. The reality it is, it's not up to this legislature to guide a future legislature in making sure they do the right thing based on the conditions and circumstances at that point in time. And, Mr. Chairman, it goes a little further than that in that most of the language in here, which you would call triggered language, is all based on a may to begin with. So very few of these triggers happen based on a budget shortfall. They're allowances of what may happen that the Joint Appropriations Committee could approve through the budget, which is authority they already have. Of course they can divert the 1% through the budget. We know they can do that. That's allowed. And we've done that in the past. Of course they can divert the 2.5% spending policy amount above the first 2.5%, the second spending policy amount. They've done that in the past. That's a standard operation, and it's within the purview of what the JAC can do. Adding to statute an allowance that they're able to do that through the budget process is certainly unnecessary because that's what they do through the budget process. Now, all of that said, there are provisions in this legislation that do exactly what we heard, which is take things that we're always putting into the budget and set them into statute so that's understood, the CREG, for example. So I think there's value to a lot of the components of this, but the concept of trying to bind future legislatures is a concern. And the final point, Mr. Chairman, that I would raise is with regard to embodying the CREG, but not just embodying it, but having them act as a trigger mechanism. I'd caution on that, and I see that as a bit dangerous. And the reason for that is the executive branch is supposed to be able to make decisions, and we're supposed to empower them based on constraints for those decisions. We create an oracle, which we're calling the CREG, and that oracle, based on what they see into the future, is going to trigger events independent of decisions made by the governor. So we're giving an executive branch power, what should be an executive branch power, to our oracle, and the trigger is contingent upon their decision. And then at the same time, we say we don't want to politicize that body. You can't have both. It's a better value for us, and it's a more valuable tool if our oracle really doesn't trigger events. If they present information, and then decisions are made by either the executive branch in their capacity or by the legislative branch in our constitutional capacity, but not acting as the trigger mechanism, that could bias the outcome, because if they see a direct consequence of their actions, now all of a sudden they are a political entity. And I think that's a dangerous path for us to go down. And I'm not saying that the idea of embodying the CREG, of maintaining it, of a lot of these provisions that we're putting in place is a bad idea. I just believe we should be cautious about having actual outcomes triggered based on their output as a statutory requirement. It's certainly something we should look at, but if we want to embody someone or empower somebody, excuse me, with a decision-making power or a trigger event, it should be the executive branch if we're not in session. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I want to debate some of those ideas and I think take some sharp disagreements with respect to what the bill does and what we have done and what history has told us. And these tools we have developed historically and put them to test over the last 4 or 5 years. We put them in the budget to test them over a few years. We've now learned that they're pretty good tools. But here are some of the concepts that we had to work with. When your budgets are going up, it's easy enough to say, we're going to leave session and we'll come back next year. We're going to leave the legislature or leave with a budget and a forecasted surplus. Hopefully we have a surplus. But when we come back, the legislature will appropriate the money. Under the Constitution, we stay under control. The issue becomes, what if we're leaving the session and we're going to limit our sessions and we're going to try not to call ourselves into special session every time a blip comes? What if, as we leave, you look at your CREG report and there's a strong admonition concern that you're going to have further reductions in revenues? And suppose your reductions are in an amount that you believe that, you know, we can absorb that, or we believe that what we ought to do is create a contingent appropriation of certain amount to be paid out of the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account. And we're going to provide that, but say it's only available under certain events. So we did the appropriation. The legislature controlled the amount of appropriation that went into the contingency reserve. And we're saying, you know, if the events occur that, and we've done this in one is $160 million. We are at about $1.5 billion plus in our rainy day fund. We thought that things were going to go hard, that we were going to have a lot, we might have had a dip that year. But we looked at the long-term forecast, and we didn't think we had to make any adjustments. We thought if there's going to be a dip, it would be a temporary dip through the year. We listened to experts, and we said, we're not prepared to come back into special session, but we will appropriate and we will set a risk limit of authority for the governor to spend. So we appropriate it. And then we say to the governor, if you, if during the session or while we're out of session, certain events take place, you may have access to those funds to prevent a structural deficit while we're gone, and we're prepared to put that at risk, but there have to be some guidelines, and one of them is the CREG report. It was a great tool. We've used it. It was used sparingly, but it allowed us to hold it. But the executive branch was always, all they had to do is hit the triggers, then it was their decision. Now, if the executive branch does that, what we ask is we ask the JAC not to act on our behalf in that sense, but them to be the reviewing entity that says, we want to see what your proposed, we're blurring issues. I'll come back to that. So the issue is on the, with respect to the triggering event, you can trigger it in certain events. The control, we set the appropriation, but there has to be some elements that we allow access to it. Now, let's get to the budget reductions. Similarly, one of the natures of the budgets is that the sooner you act in a fiscal year, the more tools you have. And if there is a dramatic loss in revenue, if we wait till the legislature meets, and at this time of the year, you've only got about 4 months to find savings in your budget. it's a lot easier to look at 12 months because you have a longer time frame, a longer horizon to make cuts. So the earlier that we react, the more prudent we can, and the better we can make these reductions, so that if the contingent funds aren't there, not available, or they've exhausted them, and there's further cuts that are needed, rather than convene a special session when the obvious is here, and that is there's a need to constrain, the governor has certain options to reduce budgets. But we do say, before you do that, you have to reveal them to JAC. And all we're saying to JAC is you can make recommendations, but the principal issue is you let JAC lets us know, and JAC can make a recommendation to that the leadership or the members call a special session. And it's an information flowing. The executive branch is still entitled to do what they propose to do. And the only solution that we have is to come back into session. But what we're not going to do is sit around and worry and think about the obvious. If cuts are needed, you make the cuts. Now, when you begin to look over on pages 19 and 18 and 19, we're talking about there, the issue becomes, and we're trying to set guidelines for JAC to provide, to set up the recommendations to us for contingency funds, recommendation for when can the governor make these cuts, under what circumstances when we're gone, and what is the depletion rate that we would recommend, they would recommend, out of the legislative stabilization reserve account or other reserve accounts. Now, there's always been discussion about what are the rules about the rainy day account. When can we get into them? How fast did we deplete them? And what we've discovered is that it is difficult, very, very difficult, if not impossible, to establish those rules. And if you're on the Revenue Committee and you went and listened to the Pew studies, you know exactly why. And the reason the Pew said, they articulated things that have been hard for us to say, but Pew study said this: Wyoming has the most volatile revenue of any state in the Union. And that's another, if you look back at Tax 2000 said we have a three-legged stool. I mean, you look at our taxes. You got sales tax, property tax, severance tax. What's missing? An income tax or something to make balance out your stool. Since we have this three-legged stool and we're so heavily dependent upon revenues from minerals, we will always see these long volatilities. And the events that lead to structural deficits or to declines in revenue are not always the same. And I would simply contrast the difference between the shortfall that we saw in the 1990s versus here today. For those that lived that experience and for those of us that came in about midway through the experience, if you go back and look at it, actually Wyoming's income over about 10 years went up at a modest, small rate. Problem is inflation was going up higher. So it felt like we were losing revenues. And it felt like we were in fact creating deferred maintenance because we weren't attending to that. Salaries were held down for a long period of time. The legislature divided itself into two groups. Half of them went to look at revenues and where we could find more revenues. Half of them went to look at expenditures and see how we could find how we could lower our expenditures. Incidentally, both groups came back. The revenue folks said there's no way to raise money. The expenditure people said we've cut all we can. During that time, we bled through a $1 billion rainy day account that was amassed during the 1980s that equaled the amount of the biennial general fund budget reserve spending at that time. So we had $1 billion set in reserve. We spent through it. Another $40 or $50 million was created when we converted from a cash accounting system to an accrual accounting system, creating a GAAP 1 and a GAAP 2 account, general accepted accounting principles accounts. There were other coffee cans, and finally, the last year we were struggling, there was at that time a federal sponge tax that provided that a portion of federal estate taxes would be paid back to the state. And we had a resident of Jackson who actually may have lived in Florida die, and we picked up about $40 million worth of sponge tax. That tax is now gone, but it was a lifesaver at the time. We assembled Tax 2000, and what they looked at, the same thing. There's no assessed valuation out there that we can look to draw upon. You need to create the fourth leg of the stool, which was recommended to be a property tax. What's different today? The most significant difference that I see today is that we sit here in a much different environment where we do see an assessed valuation or an asset to tax. Through our modern, through engineers and smart folks out there, they've developed fracking. We now have abundance of gas, deep gas, natural gas, coal bed methane. Our oil production is going up through techniques like CO2 reinjection. And our coal is massive. We have lots of volume. Uranium is not an issue. We now have in situ mining. We do have now, when we can see that there are commodities out there to tax, that wasn't the case in the 90s. I mean, we didn't know we could economically produce those commodities. The issue now is valuation and, to a certain extent, production volumes to push out. So if you had set a rule to apply to yourselves in the 1990s, it wouldn't be appropriate now. So what I think we're running into is a recognition, and this is part of the Revenue Committee's work, that what constitutes a structural deficit, what leads to a structural deficit, and how long the term is, or the term of that, the length of time for that deficit, is different each time for Wyoming. So what we need to do is give the JAC some guidelines that we think would help them in making a recommendation with respect to what is the depletion rate for the rainy day account, how long should it remain, can we go safely into a 30%, 20%, 50%. And those decisions depend largely on what's the best guesstimate as to how long we're going to be down and out. When are we going to come back? And when we come back, is there a taxable commodity? Are we going to have to raise new revenue? All those factors go in. And all we've done to here is create a list of considerations for them to consider. It's sort of a list, and the list can be bigger. If you have other ideas, put them in. But this decision with respect to the depletion rate for the rainy day account, I don't see any other way to do it other than an ad hoc basis, utilizing the best information. And at the end of the day, the JAC does make their decision about how much to invade. And I think they say this is, and they ought to be telling us, what's your recommendation? Can we do one-tenth a year? Can we do one-third a year? Does it need to last 10 years? And we want to hear what they've got to say because they spend a lot of time down here. Revenue is free to kick in, but we do need to have some recognition that there is a process, that whether it's ad hoc or whether it's a strict rule, that we are thinking about this, we're applying some standards, and it gives us the tools to explain. At first, it gives you the tool about how do you work through these issues. How do you work through it on a year-by-year, biennium-by-biennium basis? And then when you go back to report to your constituents, how do you explain and justify the methodology you use and what the result is and what your recommendation is? So it's important. We get we set up a process where we can make educated, well-informed, long-term decisions on depletion rates. At the same time, we recognize with the volatility that exists that we have tools in our quiver to intercept revenue flows, to appropriate out of the LSRA, and to even create contingency amounts, knowing that there are some instances where we would be better off to have the governor available a contingency fund rather than pulling back this session, and if all the things, if events change, we call ourselves into special session. We always maintain and retain that tool. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion on 68 before the next amendment? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, first let me compliment those involved. I think that was we heard a very good explanation. I had one, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I had one technical question. It was said that when we come down here again in a regular session, we'll have 4 months if we were to make reductions then in a budget. And, Mr. Chairman, maybe I'm missing something, but it seems to me we're in a budget session now, we're budgeting for the next biennium. When we come down here again in the general session, we will have 16 months, and 8 months of the biennium will have expanded because we're doing a biennial budget. Is there some kind of restriction that's been placed, I don't think it's in statute, but on expenditures in any year, such that we're dividing it up on a year-by-year basis, or are we really dealing with a biennial budget?
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great question, and I apologize for the confusion, but what I meant to allude to is not the biennial budget, but rather the fiscal year. So when we come arrive here, and the JAC will be talking to you, we're now in fiscal year 16 that will end in July. There is a deficit in fiscal year 16 in our current budget. And, folks, the failure to respond to a deficit in your current fiscal year can be compounding, maybe not catastrophic, but it is one of the most difficult things that you can have. The good Senator, Tall Senator from Natrona County knows, and I know these experiences, instances where in the past our county systems were not well placed, we weren't keeping track of burn rates, and we've had instances where the Department of Health expended through all their funds by June 1st. And they had an extra month to go, and their burn rate was, say, $30, $40 million a month. And so we began the fiscal year with a $20, $30 million deficit. Folks, there is nothing harder that is like your own checkbook. When you come into your new budget year, if you start out with a deficit, that's the first bill you have to pay. And you've got to pull it off. And part of the reason we have the statutory reserve, part of the reasons we are so cautious in what we do, and part of the reason that we've spent a lot of money on our new accounting software, or the modules, is to make sure agencies don't do it. The Livestock Board one time burned through all their money too fast. And it's nearly impossible it's not impossible, but it is a great hardship to try to sort through that. So when we come into any budget year, you always have to remember we are in the last 6 months to 4 months of the existing fiscal year of the last biennium. And my point there was not to say certainly when you start forecasting for the biennium, you want tools there. But we also have to deal with the shortfall this fiscal year. And when the JAC completes their discussion, they're going to talk to you about their recommendations for addressing approximately $190 million shortfall this year. And my point there is that if, in fact, you knew last summer that oil prices were going down, coal production is sliding, and the probability of a deficit was significant, it might be cautious, conservative, and prudent to call Craig, to tell them to come in and do their forecast, and then begin to execute budget shortfall measures. Now, the governor did that in this instance. When early on in the year, he put a freeze on hiring. And we know that in all hiring, there's a certain percentage of employees that turn over. It's one of the easiest ways to capture positions is by waiting to by attrition. You don't have to fire anybody. But as people retire or leave, you hold those positions and you don't fill them. And then there's no jobs aren't lost, but it's a lot easier to prepare and to reduce over a year because you have 12 months of expenditures. So I apologize for the confusion, but it is the case. We're here to deal with a fiscal 16 deficit, and that hole has to be filled before we even begin starting our biennial budget. Thank you.
Further, Senator Scott, you have a follow-up on that?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate that explanation. It makes a good deal of sense to me. I would, as a follow-on, point out to the Senate that the Medicaid budget is unique in the state government in that the spending is not controlled. Because of the way the federal program is structured, Mr. Chairman, and we have participated in that federal program since 1960, whatever it was, five or so, when it started. Because of the way that's structured, somebody who's eligible for Medicaid shows up. They have to be taken care of. And we have to pay the bill, even if we've run clear through the appropriation. And I can remember the Department of Health had to use that exact mechanism. They ran out of money. They couldn't write the check. The providers ate the float for, I think it was probably 30 to 45 days, something like that. And then that was the first thing we paid. And it took quite a while to get that deficit worked off. And we don't tolerate that anywhere else in state government. You run out of money, you run out of money. You can't spend it. And this one is different, because if we said we can't tolerate it and we won't tolerate it, the feds would say you no longer have a Medicaid program. And then we would be down here right now fixing the problem, or the people would get themselves a new legislature, because there are absolutely essential services in that existing Medicaid program. And if it's something goes wrong in the management of it, or more people just show up, we got to pay for them. And it adds considerable to the risk of this program. So it dealing with deficits there is important, because you can get one in a hurry, given health care costs, and you can get them even in relatively good times. It doesn't have to be bad times, because the demand, Mr. Chairman, goes up when the demand goes up.
And I agree with the statement, but I do want to, I do believe that there are tools that we have to address those issues. They're not easy to use. They're not popular. But if you know in advance that your burn rate is at a level that you're not going to finish out your year, one of the tools that you have, which is unpopular, is to reduce your reimbursement rates. So if physicians are receiving 80% of their customary and reasonable charges, you reduce them down to 75%. Very unpopular, but it is a tool that's available to you. Of course, it was a catastrophic event. You could come back and direct an amendment to the waiver program, not to affect your current applicants, but to start a new waiver system that could be applied. So there are actually tools to be used. They're very unpopular. But one of the things that, and in fact, they are employed because the department sets internally, unless we statutorily direct otherwise, which we have done for categories like OBGYN services delivering infants, to make sure that we have adequate OB-GYNs to deliver babies, where we direct 100% reimbursement. In other areas, we leave the discretion to the department to set by rule, regulation, policy that rate of reimbursement. I'm not saying that it's popular, appropriate, and it can affect, if you lower reimbursements at some point, your Medicaid population may not be able to achieve or receive benefits, and that can have catastrophic events. But what we do know, and the only purpose of my bringing this up, is that if you know you're going to miss your, if you know your revenues are not going to hold up or your expenditures are too high, the earlier you begin to look at your solutions, the more tools you have available. The later you wait, the fewer tools you have, and the more more money or other, your options become lower, your expenses go higher.
Chairman, that's exactly right, but there's another caveat in there you've got to pay real attention to. You have a couple of classes of key providers in both the developmental disability area and frankly, the nursing home area, where the provider is largely dependent, more than 50%, some cases up to 90%, on Medicaid reimbursements. If you reduce those reimbursements, then you create bankruptcies, and you have to be very sensitive to that. So the department doesn't have quite as much flexibility, or shouldn't have as much flexibility, as you might think, because there are a couple ways you can get in real trouble.
Further conversation, Senator Offutt.
The Phil and Charlie show. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry to interrupt the show. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to get back to a little bit of the discussion the President raised about the trigger and the need for a trigger and events that would allow for circumstances where we're out of session, and that's something I certainly agree on. I think it's just the mechanism and the level of executive autonomy that has to be in place for it to be an effective system where I'm concerned. The idea that everything would have to flow back through or be reported to the Appropriations Committee, and again, in statute there is a shall, that there shall be a report to the JAC. 30 days will be waited, up to 30 days, for recommendations by the JAC, and then only after that would the governor have any discretion. That's the type of circumstance that I find disconcerting, where we really are empowering a legislative committee with power over executive actions outside of session when the rest of us are not involved. And it's true. There's always the possibility of calling a special session. The President raised that, and that's accurate. And that is the right recourse if the legislature needs to be involved. If it merits legislative involvement, a special session is necessary so the whole body has the opportunity to weigh in. We do not empower individual committees with the ability to make decisions that are substantive in the off season. And that's intentional, because that's a violation of really how this body operates. We operate as a body, not as individual committees. Those individual committees make recommendations to the body, and then the body takes action, and it's only authoritative when the body is assembled. And I think that's appropriate. But if we want those triggers, and I think those triggers are reasonable, we just have to be cautious about what those do. And we have mechanisms, and they are contingent expenditures, but it can be as simple as if there is a budget shortfall such that revenues do not meet expenditures, then there is an authorization to perhaps intercept the 1% statutory diversion under those circumstances, or perhaps go into the 2.5%. Those types of things in statute are very reasonable. And then, of course, a reporting requirement back to JAC would be obviously a reasonable step as well, so JAC is informed. But then it would only be JAC's opportunity to call that special session if they want to go outside of the executive authority. So I think the President and the proponents on JAC are certainly bringing forward something which is necessary in essence, that we have to have a contingency plan for when we have budget shortfalls. My concern is that we don't allow for a trigger to actually take place in a way that observes correctly that separation of powers that we want to maintain. And then the other concern with regard to directing future joint appropriations committees, again, the president analyzed that and in his debate gave justifications for how we're providing guidance. Guidance is one thing, but it's a list of shalls. It's a list of these are the things that future joint appropriations committees shall do and shall report on and shall provide. And perhaps I'm missing something, but I don't know of any other circumstances where our committees are bound and obligated through law to approach problems in a certain way and come back and report along a charted path. That's not something we typically do. We try not to bind ourselves and future legislatures. We try to bind the executive branch, and I think that's consistent, again, with what our responsibilities and obligations are. A list of mays might be a very different story, and at that point it's guidance and recommendations as opposed to a shall list. So perhaps that's something that we can look at. But on that point, the final point I would make here is you think back 20 years. If 20 years ago, when they had similar circumstances to contend with, that legislature had passed a law that guided how today we handle our circumstances, I'm not sure this legislature would appreciate that. And that would be appropriate because we are empowered by the people. This legislature is empowered to represent the people of Wyoming right now. We are not empowered to represent the future people. You know, they'll make their own votes, they'll cast as they see fit, and they'll select new representatives at that point in time based on their interests. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm still concerned. I certainly appreciate the intent of this, but I have reservations to the way it's drafted.
Further conversation, Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, to answer a couple questions that came out earlier. One, there was a question about about where the earnings went and why the earnings would go into the general fund, and there was a comment about whether or not the earnings from the permanent trust fund going to the general fund, and the answer is that they do. We've got there's the spending policy amount, and there's a number of things we've got, but ultimately those revenues do go into the general fund. In the end, but then back to a couple things. First of all, my good friend from the far corner of the room is exactly right in that that legislatures. You know, do we bind ourselves? Absolutely. We do it all the time. One of the reasons you need to bind the legislature, you need to have these things in force, is because we're a part-time legislature. We're only here. So ultimately, we can come down and we could undo this entire statute in a session, but in between sessions, what is it and how should we undertake to do that? So ultimately, if we came down and there was a budget shortfall and this was instituted, ultimately, short of calling a special session, what's the direction? Where do we go? What are some things to do? If you look at the amounts that are done, it's a list, and it's certainly not an exhaustive list, but it is a list of where you would start and what you would do and things you would examine. But it doesn't require you to come back with any specific recommendation. It just tells you to take these things in and come back and recommend in these areas, very, very broad general amounts. But ultimately, absent some kind of legislation, some kind of direction, What does and how do, if you want your joint appropriations to do it, to work in a certain way or go through a certain process, if we're not in session, then you need something that would indicate that that would be the case. And ultimately, if we came down and that absolutely doesn't work, sure, we could change the statute. That's what we do. We change statutes all the time. We change statutes on ourselves. We change our rates of pay. We change our offices. We change how we work. We do those things. So we do those things, and ultimately at some point those may or may not be changed as we go through that. But the other thing I want to indicate too is we talked about trigger mechanisms and using the Craig Estimating Group as a trigger mechanism. This Craig Estimating Group, if you read it, in some ways is a trigger mechanism because that's the revenue. But there's nothing that requires them to be a trigger mechanism. It's just that that's what we look for to determine our revenues. Not just us. It goes out to the budget division. It goes out to the executive. It goes out to our county commissioners. As a county commissioner, if you've been a county commissioner, we look at our credit reports, and that's part of the process we go through as we analyze and create our budgets back at the state and local levels, is by looking and referring to those credit reports. I also came back, and staff handed me a list of all the places that Craig has mentioned in the statutes already. And so there are multiple places. And in fact, in one place that does act as a trigger point is, as the treasurer makes distributions out to counties and quarterly distributions of taxes and other things, they're doing it based upon the most recent Craig report that comes out. So the fact and the concept that Craig and looking at the Craig report involves it, and ultimately, as the governor looks at the Craig report, or he can look at other information, determines there's a shortfall in revenue or that the revenue is not going to be lesser than anticipated, the governor then acts. It would be the same with respect to anybody, the county commissioners. If you've got a Craig report and it says it's down, if you don't take some corrective action to bring your budget in line with your anticipated revenues, then you're not doing your job. So that Craig, the fact that the purpose, as the president stated, of the Craig was to simply get everybody on the same page and try and working from the same things. The last thing I would say about JAC is, you know, it may be this JAC. I don't plan on being on JAC next year. So one way or the other. Whatever poor suckers of you are going to be on JAC, you know, you may want some guidance. But ultimately, one thing that was said, and I think it was just a misstatement. I don't think it was intended, but JAC has no power to call a special session. I think there was some inclination on that. And certainly JAC on its own doesn't have any power to do anything else. As we make recommendations, all of you, you think about your committees, you all make recommendations on various policy matters and other things that come back to the legislature. And so ultimately we make our recommendations. Our budget is a recommendation, but obviously the body can do with it as they will. And thank you.
Further discussions, Mr. President?
These are all pretty, excuse me, who did you call on?
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, it's all pretty important, and this is important discussion. We're putting something in statute, some of these things we've been tested at time, but JAC is an interesting animal. I just doing a Westlaw search, I think JAC is mentioned probably 100 times in different statutes. And we do have a policy, and it is the case that we do not delegate our activities of the board or of the group to anyone. We reserve that to ourselves. And I want to characterize in my own words what I think that this bill is trying to do. The issue with respect to the 30 days is really that's the period of time we think it's necessary for us to have notification of what's intended to happen so we can react to whether or not we as a governing or as a body want to call ourselves back in session. But the enforcer, if you will, of that 30-day period needs to be somebody. We delegate that sort of enforcement to the JAC, and we say to JAC and to the governor, you give at least 30 days notice to JAC. Now, we do ask our committees to do activities during the summer and report to us. And in this case, what we're asking the JAC to do is to receive that report, analyze it, and make a recommendation to us so that we can determine whether or not it warrants a special session. And it's unlikely that it could be that if the governor makes a recommendation of $15, $20, $30 million worth of cuts or $100 million, that if it was received by any single member, they might be able to figure out pretty quickly what it is, what the impacts are. But certainly, we would generally what we would always do and we'd like to do is we tell JAC, receive that report, and we'd like to ask you to convene and have a hearing on it. Make sure you understand it and make a recommendation to us whether to call the session. Now, it may be that there's heartburn with the provision where the JAC provides comments and recommendations back to the governor. That would be non-binding. And maybe the heartburn is that doesn't speak for me because JAC doesn't always speak for me. And yet there are all kinds of, I mean, the JAC could provide that, those suggestions regardless, but you would want that. It might be the JAC's recommendation is don't implement it for 45 days because we think we're going to call, we're going to recommend to leadership a special session. It might be that JAC says, hey, you're spending funds from an unauthorized source. You don't have that authority. Those things take place very often or quite often. But I think the governor, everybody knows that those are just JAC concerns. JAC provides those comments to everybody, and they facilitate it. But it's not a delegation to them to act on our part. But we do this throughout for all interim committees. There's communications that happens between the Health Committee and Department of Health and recommendations of you can do this or you can't do this. They may not reach an agreement. If they don't like the reimbursement policy or they change the policy, we ask our joint committees to communicate with the committees they oversee. If you're the travel, wreck, and wildlife, if you see something happens in Game and Fish and the committee makes a recommendation, it's not binding, but certainly we don't prohibit a committee from making a recommendation. So that's a pretty common event. So don't find there's no boogeyman out there. The real issue here is if we provide contingency resources and we provide the limitations upon which they can be used, or we authorize budget cutting with limitations of when they can be invoked, those are not intended to go for the governor simply to say, well, I didn't like that program, I'm going to cut it. But if you do that, then by gosh, give us notice, give us time to react, and call ourselves in the session if we don't like that result. Thank you.
Further discussion on 68. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be brief, and I'll ask for the answer to this question to be delivered at a later time so we don't have to burn a bunch of floor time. We're all ready to go to lunch. I think the Vice President mentioned that all of the funds that there were income from the Permanent Mental Trust Fund went to the general fund. My question would be, how many automatic statutory appropriations are there in statute for those funds, and what other automatic statutory appropriations exist before we went into session, and what automatic statutory distributions are contained in the bills that we have, this bill, the budget bill. I'm looking at those things that we pass them, we forget about them, they come back, and we just wonder what happened. And so that's the question that I have. I don't need the answer now. If we could have an answer, I would appreciate it at a later time.
Further discussion on 68 before we move on to the amendment. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have the privilege of the floor, if I don't mind disturbing this fun that we're having.
Granted, sir.
Oh, yes. Yes, I'd like to make an introduction. Today with us we have some folks from Skills USA. Their assistant, their state associate director, Tony Decklever, are here with the students. Skills USA is a partnership of students, teachers, and industry representatives working together to ensure America has a skilled workforce. And so today we have the leadership of the chapter from Gillette, Rollins, Cheyenne, and Sheridan. Please help me give them a warm welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I yield back.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Welcome to the Senate. Is there any further discussion on 68, Senate File 68, before we move on to the amendment? Senator Burns, I think, is just stretching. So, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, would the reading clerk please read it in?
Senate File 68, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 5, line 13.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I ask that the body remove that from the floor, and I pull it.
Okay. We remove Committee of the Whole Number 1 to 68 has been
withdrawn.
We're on Committee of the Whole Number 2. Would the reading clerk please read it in?
Senate File 68, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, delete, page 6, line 19.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Number 2 to Senate File 68 and ask for your favorable consideration. Members, I got up a couple times when we were talking about the Craig Group on page 6 and talked a little bit about the committee's actions and the need to go just a little bit further to maintain the same type of services that we're getting, and the importance of the group being able to meet, the fact that, as I said earlier, that they share proprietary information, sensitive information. It's kind of like a working draft of a bill. When you first put a bill out there and the first draft, you're kind of, looking at it. And then, if you have some glaring mistakes, you have an opportunity to repair those before you put that product out into the public. And the amendment definitely shares the fact that, its workings are not open to the public, but its final products certainly are. And that just keeps it protects the group, and it keeps them working the same way they've always been, and ask for your favorable consideration.
Any further discussion? Yes, Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On in support of this Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, when we did the Standing Committee Amendment, it was pretty conceptual. We went back to staff and worked out this amendment, which I believe is much more appropriate to urge your favorable consideration.
Okay, any further discussion on Committee of the Whole 2? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Hastert's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Number 2 to Senate File 68, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Number 2 to Senate File 68 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We're on Committee, no further discussion. We're on Committee of the Whole Number 3. Senator Bebout.
I ask it to be read in.
Senate File 68, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3, corrected copy, page 17, line 13.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 3 to Senate File 68. Mr. Chairman, we've had some great discussion about this particular bill, and a little background before I get into the specifics of the amendment. But, we talked about lately Wyoming in the last 3 or 4 years has been voted as one of the best-run states in the country, and part of that is our fiscal responsibility, not only trying to build our permanent mill trust fund, but setting up the LSRA and the balances in that LSRA account. And, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the nature of these boom-bust cycles, we've seen these cycles. Usually some of them have lasted for 1 or 2 years, and the dynamics of this one sure could indicate that it might be like we had in the 80s and 90s. We might be in for a 10-year stretch. And if you look at that, we need to have some fiscal constraint as to how much money we spent from LISRA. And the President of the Senate talked about the Pew report, and a lot of you need to read that. It talks and speaks a lot about what we should do as a state to look for the ups and downs, cyclical nature of a state that's so dependent on minerals. And one of the things, in fact, they recommended is that you should have a reserve account equal to your 2-year budget appropriations, which would be about $3 billion. I support that, think that makes a lot of sense. We never quite got there, and we're about $1.8 billion. So what I'm attempting to do with this, Mr. Chairman, is to limit the amount of money we use every year out of the LISRA account to balance our budget and spend on government. You can talk about all day long the importance and the growth of government. All these programs are necessary. They all have their own constituency. But ultimately, Mr. Chairman, being from the private sector, when times are difficult, you have to make substantial reductions in how you spend your money. And I would submit to the body, the members of the Senate, there are private people out there that are taking 25% and 30% cuts, not only small businesses, but large corporations in our country and around the world. So it only makes sense that we further exercise some financial restraint in how we spend the legislative reserve account. And, Mr. Chairman, what this does, and you pick a number, I'm open to suggestions, but right now the JAC and their recommendation for this budget bill we have in front of us spend about $108.7 million each year of this 2-year biennium out of that LISRA account. And Mr. Chairman, what this does is that we're not going to spend no more than that. And if you think about your personal assets and you have savings, and I remember as a businessman in that short boom that lasted a long time in the 80s and 90s, You know, you always pay your bills, you always pay your people, you pay your taxes, and then you go into savings to do that. And if you try to spend all your money the first year or second year, your business is going to fail. So you have to make cuts and be appropriate or be responsible in how you deal with those funds initially. So what this does, it really sets some sideboards, Mr. Chairman, that says we're not going to run out. We could spend a lot more money than we are right now if we wanted to during this budget cycle. Very bad idea. We don't want to compromise on a long-term strategy for short-term interest. So we cap that at $108.7 million per year out of the LISR account, Mr. Chairman. I sent a sheet around to all of you to look at the impact that would have on that. And if you look out 10 years, we get down to $1 billion, and some would say, well, why not go to zero? The reason I would like to leave that there, Mr. Chairman, is we have to remember the peer report that we need to have at least $1 billion in place for us to take care of our needs that we might have in the future. If you go to zero on that, this cycle lasts longer. We have just a short phase where the commodity prices come back and we go back into another area of bust. We really find ourselves in a bind. So this is some real long-term planning, Mr. Chairman. If you look at the bill, it really does, it covers two areas. One is on page line 17, we talk about where the governor shall not recommend a continued appropriation that would be more than a $108.7 million. And then on page 18, line 13, that the JAC will not recommend any more than 118.7. And then line 19, page 19, line 7, just makes it statutory consistent with the bill. I think it's a good idea. I think it represents some fiscal constraint by this body. We need to look to the future more than this two-year budget cycle. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Further discussion on Committee of the Whole Number 3 Amendment. Senator Office.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the amendment, once again, while we can have our philosophies at this point in time about what we should and shouldn't recommend, binding this legislature, working our budget right now, it's not our responsibility to make that decision for future legislatures. They'll make recommendations as they see fit, and they should, and we should not attempt to bind those recommendations at this point in time because we think we know what's best, not just now, but for the future. At the same time, binding the governor and prohibiting the governor from making recommendations in the same manner is not our responsibility. It's the governor's responsibility to make his budget recommendations as he sees fit. It's then that session's Joint Appropriations Committee that is going to review those, bring them to this body for the budget. So while I don't disagree with Majority Floor Leader in the intent of really thinking through and having a conservative approach to the future and how we spend that, we don't want a fast burn rate. I certainly concur on that. I think that we need to be very sensitive at this point in time to how we do that and thoughtful. It still does not allow us to bind that future legislature from making a different decision. It's just not our responsibility. Even if we agree with it, even if we think it's the right choice, it's not our choice to make. It's their choice in the future.
Thank you. Further discussion on Amendment Number 3. Senator Pappas.
On and for the amendment, Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, as I was looking at this, I thought, oh, yes, it does bind future legislatures. But, frankly, we can come back next year and change it. I really think that it gives us gives the JAC and gives the governor some guidance, even though it is in statutes and it does bind. But there's really no reason why we just can't come back and change it should we need to. So I really don't see it as a threat that it binds the legislature that much. Certainly it will be codified in law. But I frankly think that the guidance that it provides is valuable. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion on number 3. Question being called. Senator Office.
Just to address that briefly, Mr. Chairman, for my second time, this is statute, and therefore it is binding until a new statute is passed. So this would officially bind the next session. Unless legislation was passed to do otherwise, that legislation would not be passed until after the session. So as a minimum, we would be binding 1 year of this legislature, assuming that we changed it next year. And then it would be an entirely separate legislature thereafter that we would be potentially constraining. So I recognize the fact that it can change, Mr. Chairman, but at the same time, there's no question that we would at least be legally binding 1 year of the legislature in the future from making their own decisions, because we know better today without actually having any evidence of what's going to happen and without the benefit of knowing the circumstances that that legislature will face.
Further discussion on number three. Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, either on or for this particular amendment, and I think over the three readings that we need to really have a hard focus on this. But what I would caution folks is that we have the direct appropriations that are actually appropriated directly in the budget out of the LSRA. And then we have provisions for contingent appropriations. Those are the ones that we would say to the governor, you can access outside of session up to X amount of dollars, $60 million, $10 million, $20 million, in the event that certain things happen in order to prevent to address a temporary shortfall. So that if you have a quick drop, it's going to jump back up, you can access that. And we have given the authority to the governor in the past. I think as we're moving forward, it would be wise of us to say, sort of maybe set a guideline, and the guideline doesn't have to apply to the governor or specifically him. We just do it, said in the absence of, our general recommendation is that the budgets do not deplete either through direct appropriations or contingency appropriations more than X amount. And if we can come up an amount that we think is an appropriate total cap for all the entire potential depletion as a recommendation so that there's some guideline to follow, certainly people can choose or see circumstances that would warrant not following that recommendation. But I think the depletion rate for all dollars that come out and setting a target is a prudent idea, but it should apply to contingent appropriations, direct appropriations that we have in this budget, like $35 million in the second biennium, and there's going to be recommendation for funds out of the statutory reserve. So we may say, look, I mean, for all the dollars we're pulling in, we got to focus on the structural deficit and make sure that we're not using these funds to perpetuate a structural deficit that's going to create a substantial cliff when the revenues are gone. So you need to be working into it. Part of this is, you know, if you know your money's going to come up, you've got one set of circumstances, but if you're projecting this, a long-term decline or plateau, if you don't react, you can create a cliff, and what we're trying to do is prevent that cliff effect. And it does seem to me that you may want to say that in the absence of better information, let's not deplete our entire reserves by more than 10 or 15% a year or biennium. So, but as we move forward, let's be careful that we're talking about contingent appropriations. Those are the ones that we allow the governor to access that are not directly appropriated. Direct appropriations are the ones we directly appropriate in the budget, so we need to be cautious of these terms, make sure that we're all on the same page.
Further discussion on Senator Bevout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly, we need to break for lunch. The President makes a good point, and I will take a look at that. I would still ask you to support this amendment. I think it really puts some sideboards in and makes a lot of sense for the state.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Bevout's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 3 to Senate File 68, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
The chair's in doubt. With those in favor of Committee of the Whole number 3 to Senate File 68, please stand. No's are loud. Would those opposed to Committee of the Whole number 3 to Senate File 68 please stand? You're a loud group, too. It's 21-7. Committee of the Whole number 3 to Senate File 68 has passed Committee of the Whole, and we're back on the bill. Senator Bebout. We're back on the bill. Question haven't been called. All those in favor of Senator, I'd have to look, Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 68, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 68 is passed the Committee of the Whole. Senator Bebout?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise and sit again at 1:30.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Mr. President? 1:30.
I need to call. Just say I call the phone, or just.
No report until after.
Okay. Are there any announcements? Well, I'm going to list one soldier back. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet in 30 minutes in room S-19 to pick up Senate Files 62, Homemade Beverages, and I understand there's going to be free samples, Mr. President. So.
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, your Appropriations Committee is going to meet in about 10 minutes as soon as we can grab something to eat to hear the following bill, Senate File 53, Large Project Funding, Senate File 101, Public Health Laboratory Fees, and then 3, Re-Referral, Senate Joint Resolution 1, Senate File 25, and Senate File 86.
Where?
In our appropriations room, L-55.
Senator Hammer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, will meet this afternoon upon adjournment, General Room S-27, Senate File 80, Water Use Outside the State, Senate Joint 4, Labeling for Genetically Engineered Items 2, Senate File 90, Lifetime Game and Fish, Purple Heart Recipients, Senate File 98, Food Freedom Act, Sales Locations, and Senate File 52, State Shrub.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 9, Minerals and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow at noon, about 15 minutes after recess, in Jonah Room S-18, Senate File 63, Economic Development Program Revisions, Senate File 72, 70 miles per hour speed limit, Senate File 78, Office of the Consumer Advocate repeal date.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Judiciary Committee number 1 will meet tomorrow, Wednesday the 17th, at 7 a.m. This is a revised at 7 a.m. at the Jonah Room S-18. To consider the following bills, Senate File 6, First Judicial District, Number of District Judges, Senate File 89, Workers' Compensation, Time for Requesting Hearing, and Senate File 51, Post-Conviction Actual Innocence.
Senator Landon.
Mr. President, your Committee Number 4, Education, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock a.m., Jonah Room S-19, to consider Senate File 94, Payment for Educational Services.
Any other announcements? You've heard the motion of the majority floor leader. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Senate shall stand in recess until 1:30 p.m.